some of the things that you're hoping that we will move into the budget. And you've asked us to do a Section 300 on the advanced conversion technology grants. As I've told the committee before, one of the a potential applicant is Nerd Energy, and my son is one of the engineers with that company, and so I will not vote on that item, but nonetheless, we still have to get meet what the committee's needs are. So, Eli, the floor is yours.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I have Rob with me today, too, to talk about some of these issues. And one of the main things we're doing with the Minerals Committee in terms of the, I think, some important things for the future of our state is we talked a lot about opportunity that exists out there to take our minerals and our natural gas and convert them to liquids. And we talked about coal before, and you're all familiar with the DKRW project over by Hanna that's looking at coal to natural gas or coal to liquids and or diesel. And we also have an opportunity to do natural gas. And as this conversation started, and primarily one of the companies that brought to us this idea, it looked like we might want to change the focus of the Clean Coal Task Force. And you're all very familiar with the Clean Coal Task Force. They serve two functions. One is that they're sort of the counsel for the School of Energy Resources, but they also review coal-related projects and research. And the Clean Coal Task Force analyzes different submittals to that group. And then there's a matching requirement that's part of their proposal. Then they vote on them, report to the Minerals Committee, and do the kind of information and research that's really important to our coal industry. And so what we thought about doing, since there's other avenues available to take our minerals and convert them to liquids, we wanted to change the focus of the Clean Coal Task Force. There's another bill, Mr. Chairman, out there. The Advanced Conversion Technologies Program is now the Clean Coal Program. There's a bill that will change the name of that to the Advanced Conversion Technologies Task Force, and then they in turn will not only do what they're doing with clean coal and those kind of projects that we have in place now, but also look at these advanced conversion technologies. And this is primarily, like I mentioned just a little bit ago, natural gas to gasoline. And it's a thing that the technology is out there. It's not new science. It's not something that needs to be researched on. They're up and running plants throughout the world. We thought it made a lot of sense to look at those opportunities in Wyoming. There are substantial investments. A plant that will take about 100 million cubic feet a day of natural gas can convert that into 10,000 barrels of gasoline. And it's one of the few areas in our state, if we had one of those plants and up and running, that as our natural gas prices go down, it makes that more cost effective. Because if you're all very familiar with the ratio we used to have, where you could take the price of natural gas and multiply by 7, and that would be the price of oil. That relationship has totally changed over the last 4 or 5 years, and that ratio is now about 25. So you can see the benefits if you look at the cost of natural gas relative to like $2.50 an MCF versus $100 a barrel for oil, and you can see the economics of this really make a lot of sense. It's a big project, and there's a lot of steps that need to be required to complete that. And the biggest one probably is a feed study, they call it. And a feed study is where they've actually done some preliminary economics. The company that has the opportunity or feel like they have the plan put together that they could proceed with this kind of a project will go out and spend $10, $20 million to do a preliminary feed study. And the feed study is really kind of a final engineering plan put together where they will actually cost it out, go to suppliers and different people and contractors and come up with a real fixed cost to then, once they have that in place, to be able to do the economics and go to the financing phase. And what the purpose of the Section 300 that I have in front of you is to facilitate a way to help in that particular process. And the plan, if I could walk through this very quickly, Mr. Chairman, is to set up, and with the now becoming Advanced Conversion Technologies Task Force, is to allow them to have a one-time appropriation of $500,000, and it's very clear in there that they will determine the feasibility of constructing a commercial-scale minerals-to-liquid fuels facility in Wyoming. We put certain criteria in there that's included in this Section 300 we think they need to be looking at as they proceed with this. It's still up to the company that wants to do that to spend the initial money to come to the task force to even be able to have them consider them as a possibility to be looked at. And that number is between $300,000 and $400,000 worth of capital that they will have to expend to do their preliminary study to be even to get to this step. So it's really several steps. The first step is a company recognizes that there's potential and puts together sort of a quick business plan. The second step is they hire like a Fluor or American Bechtel or one of these large engineering construction companies to do the next phase level to see if the economics really do make sense. Then the third step would be to come to the Clean Coal Task Force, now the Advanced Conversion Technologies Task Force, and ask for the opportunity to be considered for the other part of this bill, which is up to $10 million matching grant to allow them to proceed. So that they would come to the task force with this preliminary $300,000 to $400,000 study. The task force will in turn hire an engineering consulting firm with banking expertise to look at that, make a decision based on the criteria we've said, and see if it makes sense for that plant to go forward in Wyoming. If they do, then what they would do is report to the Minerals Committee that they recommend, and there are several companies out there right now looking at this. There's three of them, actually. They would recommend to the Minerals Committee which one of these, if any, makes sense to proceed to take the up to $10 million, understanding they have to match that. And then we would pass our recommendations on to the governor's office, and he would have the veto power to say yay or nay. You know, we can't, as a legislative body, we can't do things in the off-season in terms, we can only appropriate or authorize. We can't actually spend it. That's the executive branch. So they would do that, and the project would proceed. And, Mr. Chairman, that's really what the Section 300 is all about, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick one. So the 500,000 feed study, 10 million actual construction of the plant.
No. Mr. Chairman, no. The 500,000 would be for the task force to evaluate their preliminary feed study to see if it meets our criteria to move forward to do the actual feed study they have to do to get throughout the financing package and proceed. So the 500 is the first step. The 10 million would, up to 10 million would be where they require the matching grant, and that they would proceed in that level.
So, just one follow-up: the 10 million matching grant to what exactly are we getting for the 10 million?
Mr. Chairman, that would be for the actual feed study, where they go out to the engineering firm and do the very specific design, look at the cost, look at all of the internal factors and the cash flow to be able to go to financing and see if they can actually put it together.
Eli, a couple things. Page 2, regulatory issues. Now, this is in the first 500,000 from us, and then you said there'd probably be $300,000 to $400,000 from the other company. So you've got roughly $1 million to look at those things that are under Romanet 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Is that where we're at,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer? Yeah, that's correct. What we'll do is they would do that. They have to do that first preliminary study to be able to even compete under an RFP to have the task force look at them. If they're accepted and recommended, and then ultimately we go along with them, the governor signs off, then they would go to the next level, which would be up to the $10 million for their internal feed study, which is a complete design, engineering, costed out situation.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, a follow-up on that. So the regulatory issues, I guess that's whether or not we can get an air quality permit issued in the first place or get an idea how much, I guess, in this study about how much we're going to emit in the atmosphere, and then we see whether or not we can cross those thresholds and those type of things.
Mr. Chairman, correct. And what we did is we went to the School of Energy Resources Council and asked for their input, since it's private sector people that have been involved in these kind of things in their career. And they had three things that thought would also help, as well as this. And one of them is helping in the regulatory area, permitting, and those kinds of things.
A little fleshing out in subparagraph C, if you would, Mr. Chairman. Eli, we're looking at, you said it's for the purpose of supporting the construction and operation of a commercial-scale facility. So we actually don't build a scale facility or begin a commercial-scale facility. This is just in maybe some engineering, the actual engineering of the plant, then they cost out what is going to go into the plant, how much it's going to actually cost, determine the capacity, and then determine whether or not. So do you get the engineering actually in this the space for the plant, so you know what you have to buy to build a plant. Is that what we're doing here?
Mr. Chairman, correct. And this is not a research project. The technology has been proven. What we have to determine is, based on these factors we put into this in the section 300, is that it makes sense in Wyoming based on the feedstock, natural gas, the price of gasoline on the tailgate that we would get for the product. And it would be a complete engineering study. Then the company would go to the financing package to be able to put together a plant like this one. The one that we've looked at least is considered, I mentioned 100 million cubic feet a day, 10,000 barrels of gasoline, is about a $1.8 to $2 billion project. And it will be built in Wyoming, of course. And the other important thing, if you notice in that criteria, is water.
Yeah.
And they have to have a good source of water.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so I want to make sure I understand this. This first $500,000, is that going to the Clean Coal Task Force? As it you mentioned task force in that paragraph A, but the money's going to School of Energy. But is it what is now existing as a Clean Coal Technology or Task Force? Is that who we're speaking of, is the kind of the governing body of that?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay.
And we are proposed to change the name of that to the Advanced Conversion Technologies Task Force. But the $500,000 goes to them.
Okay, so... And then that group, however its composition or its name is, has grant money available, and people will apply to do this under A, to do feasibility studies themselves, or the School of Energy is doing these feasibility studies?
Mr. Chairman, good question. No, they will have to do that initial $300,000 to $500,000 part themselves to determine if it even makes sense from their levels. And that's what needs to be done. And they'll do like a preliminary, if you will, engineering cost study. Then if that makes sense, and the purpose of the $500,000 is to give expertise to the task force to get outside people to evaluate that. The proposal. They didn't feel like they had the internal expertise to be able to pick and choose.
Okay.
So the $500,000 goes to a banker/engineer/firm that can really evaluate to see if what they said and bring it to the table makes sense to go to the next step, which would be, as Senator Meyer talks about, a more complete engineering design and costed project.
Okay, so then they come in with an RFP basically to us, and then we hire this outside help that analyzes their proposal, says, yeah, this kind of makes sense. This looks like it'll work. And then they can apply for this up to $10 million. I don't really see it. But they could apply up to $10 million, not that they've got the financing and everything in place and land looked scoped out and everything. It's just that to get the next step, to get the engineering drawings done, so we could have $10 million of state money into something like the, you know, we got a mythical power station near my town, and, you know, we're 8 years into or 7 years into DKRW. Are we possibly stretching our money out like that, or even not even getting something at the end after we do this? Is there any guarantee?
Mr. Chairman, there's no guarantee. This is at risk because you have that's the purpose of bringing the outside consultants in to really analyze it very carefully and look at the numbers. And that's the part. And if you look at the smaller type companies that are going to be doing this thing in Wyoming, they don't have the internal $20 million to throw at it. So that's the incentive we're bringing it. But yet we want the match.
Eli, I think maybe one of the things that we need to put in here, and I don't know whether you thought about it, or maybe it's already in here, is the engineering studies, the results from that $10 million match. Let's say they actually have to spend $20 million to get the plans and the blueprints of the and all the specifications of, you know, whether they got compressors or boilers or what, I'm not sure, the process, fracking towers, or whatever they need to use, all the plumbing, the stainless steel nuts, pipes, bolts, electrical systems. I'm assuming you're getting something that's going to be basically turnkeyed so they can go out into the financial market and say, okay, this is what it is. It's all scoped out. We know exactly every make, model, specification, grade of everything that's going to happen in this plant. And... It'd be nice to know that if that fell through, at least the state would have the plan, the benefit of it for anybody subsequent. So maybe we say something that these guys have got 10 years to get their financing and the plant built after the engineering phase, and then then that's open domain. Or maybe it's open domain just as soon as we spend the first state dollar. I don't know. Have you had any thoughts of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marg, that's a good point, and I failed to mention to you that we have a bill that the committee has put together similar to this, and in that bill we talked about intellectual property. And since the state has vested at $10 million, up to $10 million in it, that, yes, they will have intellectual property. And that's part of the agreement that will be negotiated between the prospective company and the state if, in fact, the state decides to put up money, is that whatever comes of that $10 million plus their match, the state will have intellectual property rights to that. And we had some language in that bill, and it's not in here, and that's a good point.
So Senator DeVito, they would be open-ended as far as ever getting started? Or can we put a, you know, as Senator Meyer mentioned, a 10-year, you got to have something done in 10 years, 11 years, 12 years, or pay back our money?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this isn't a loan. This is when we if they do the 10 million, they qualify, and everybody wants to move forward with it. The 10 million plus their match or whatever it is up to, that's money that's spent and it's gone. It's not a loan.
Yes.
So the match is there. And as far as putting a time element on it, I hadn't thought about it. You could always do that, but it's. I mean, if they're going to spend the kind of money they're doing and all the time and effort to put into this project, they're not. They're going to try to get it done as quickly as possible, and particularly when you look at the main factor in this is the price of natural gas, pretty critical.
Mr. Chairman, follow up on that. Yes, you know, we have two potential projects. One has been sitting around for about 13 years now, and one's been sitting around about six or seven. And if we're going to put out this money with that kind of history behind us, I think we want a little more guarantee on return on it. Not, I mean, this kind of money to a GE or some company of that size is pittance, but why not set up a few people and go for it? If it works out, great. We build you something that fits into what we're what we want to do, and it's profitable to the 40% of return or whatever they shoot for. Go for it. But if it's not, they just walk $10 million. Oh well. I just think we need more guarantee that something will materialize after X number of years.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what you have to do, and this is not a test. This is not a little model that we're going to analyze and see if it works. The technology is there. The thing that will make this work is putting it together in terms of a business plan and a model that fits Wyoming, and it works for it based on the price of the commodity going in and the output. So this isn't a test to see if it works. So that's one of the big differences. To try to put some kind of a loan guarantee or something in, I think defeats the purpose of what we're doing. And if we, you know, these kind of plants, there's a good chance some of them are going to be built, like on the Gulf Coast, where there's a lot of gas and a lot of access to gas, and they're going to be doing the bigger projects. We're trying to see if we could do this to Wyoming. And, of course, the real benefits to the state is we have another place to put 100 million cubic feet of gas away. Of course, you collect the severance and ad valorem on that gas.
Oh, I see the huge, huge value to the state. I'm all behind that. But, you know, we have a power station that's in 12 years of development. I don't know if it'll ever go. A lot of industrial revenue bonds tied up in it, blah, blah, blah. And that's known technology. You know, you can burn coal and produce electricity. They do it all over the United States. So it's not the fact that this is known technology makes it so different. It's just that in X number of years, it would be nice to know that there was a guarantee we're getting our money back or this goes. And we really want it to go, and we don't want to tie up our resources in one company that just fades out where we could have been taking care of maybe several. You know, I don't know the subjects as well as you do, but that's my first shot at it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess you could do as you will in the appropriations. If you wanted to say it's a grant and you expect to be paid back, I mean, that's certainly up to this committee. I think that would put a different light on it. But, you know, if that's something that you want to proceed with,
yeah.
You know, that's just part of the debate. And, I mean, we need to really air this thing very carefully. There's such huge potential here. That's why we're bringing it to you. This is why we're coming to the appropriations committee instead of just doing a bill. We wanted you to see this up front, have a chance to think about it, and come with your comments and your judgment.
Mr. Chairman, one last comment is I don't want it to be a loan, but I want something produced at the end of this whatever period of time, and that's where it could turn into a loan. But I would really like it to be a grant because the payback's enormous for the state.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, we could put in some time limits. Maybe Rob would like to comment on that. Of course, Rob's been here on the front end of this. Would you like to add any of that, Rob?
Mr. Chairman, Rob Hurlis, it's a great point because I know the projects that you're speaking of, and that's frustrating. I agree with Chairman Bebout that the folks that I've talked to that are contemplating these really want to make it work. I think it's unlike some of the major that you mentioned, this would be a significant amount of money for accelerating. I guess one of the ways I look at that is it's a process of accelerating a project that may otherwise go. And so I think that's one of the purposes of that owner's engineer that does the due diligence to say, you know, how real is this and what are its chances, and have that airing done before or in the context of the advanced conversion task force. And I've watched those folks with respect to the clean coal things, and they're very serious about their responsibilities, and they take their monetary responsibilities very serious, and I would expect nothing less than this. So it's hard to think of a way, although we might be able to do it, to put more of an action exclamation point on that. But I tend to agree with Chairman Bebout that the folks that I think will apply are pretty highly motivated. It still means that somebody's got to make a judgment about a feasibility study, but I think the way this is structured, you have your best chance to do some serious due diligence before any serious money of that $10 million is spent. So that would be my take on it.
One question. Are we going to work on this as far as where the money comes from, those kind of issues, later, or is that something for discussion?
I think the notion is that this is a markup issue. What Minerals is asking us to do is to build it into the budget. I think the idea is to build it in, take a look at the AML slots and see if this has equal or higher priority than something else is already there. Maybe if we've been already talking about the demands, but the Minerals co-chairs have really asked is that, and this, by the way, has gone to the governor's office. I don't know how he'll do his letter, but the knowing that resources are getting tight, Minerals is saying, look, you got the other two $10 million ones, and this is the third $10 million. They'd like us to make a slot for it.
There is some, not time limits on some of the AML, but as far as it, because you bill and then you get paid. So
well,
I
what
think
happens on the AML is once we tie a project, the application gets made and the dollars are there encumbered until we spend them. So they can be encumbered for 10 years or something like that, forever. I think Ken was next.
Yeah, that was pretty much my question, Mr. Chairman. If we're looking at general fund money, are they the possibility of them being tied up for a longer period of time? Or if they're going to be in the governor's office, we also have the option of diverting money that may otherwise flow into one of our savings accounts in a Section 300, or it's essentially going to be in a savings account, isn't it?
And in a sense, when we get to markup, we'll put this on as one more item to be made space for, and it gets debated. And either we find the space or we don't. But it's easier to put through the budget process than it is later. And I think they've got essentially a quiver of projects for these mineral projects that they'd like to find a home for, and this is the time to do it. It's in markup. It just gets harder if we don't do it now.
And, Mr. Chairman, we didn't put a time element because we figured it was a budget, so it was a two-year cycle. If nothing happens, then standard language would revert the money to wherever you wanted to put it. That was the way I anticipated doing it with a Section 300. So if after 2 years, if it, no one's none of them look good enough, then it's something we looked at. It didn't make sense, and we move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, when I think back to the other grants we've awarded through the Clean Coal Technology, and I think a strong component, educational component, research, feasibility, and that said, I see this first component, that 500,000 strong research feasibility component. When I look at the 10 million, it occurs to me that perhaps we're becoming a partner with industry, which, again, looking back, some of the grants we've appropriated, NCAR, the GE, in my mind, the strong public benefit component has been the educational component, the UW tie to it. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, the question, how do you make that public benefit component to this $10 million? Is it the economic benefit? Is that your where you're hanging your hat? Or talk to me about that. It's the one thing that we have a constitutional responsibility for this public benefit component.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, and we did look at the constitutionality of it, the way we structured this entire thing to ensure that we were constitutional, and I really believe that we are. As far as an education component, this isn't about educating relative to this type of a process in terms of, like, the Clean Coal Task Force looks at strictly research. This is a plant that's up and ready with the technology in place to move forward, so it's the economic benefits to creating jobs and opportunities and wealth to the state. It's a long-term project. Once it's there, it'll be there a long time, and also for a place for our natural gas to be utilized within our state. It's value-added, and that's the whole thing that's driving it, is how we can take our natural resources that we have an abundance of and try to keep that value in our state other than just selling the molecules or the electrons. And that's what's really driving it, is an economic benefit. And if you look at some of these plans, and Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to provide to the committee, and I guess we should have done that, Rob, is the INL did a preliminary fee study on this thing that was very lucrative. They had like a 25 or 30 ROI, internal rate of return, on their investment, and that's what sparked our interest. And I could sure supply that to the committee, and, Rob, we could do that, I think, couldn't we, and let you take a look at that preliminary analysis. We've already done one, then there's another, then a third component to look at it before we actually go to the feed study. So we're trying to really protect the state's funds because it is at risk. But the benefits on the other side relative to the rate of return are huge. And we thought it was certainly worth bringing to this committee and a good way to spend one-time money for long-term benefits.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Did the committee talk about, I mean, there's other ways to incentivize instead of cash up front. Did you look at any kind of, you know, tax incentives on the backside if it ever gets rolling? Did you discuss that to kind of meet the same thing, but instead of being on the front, it'd be on the back end?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. We looked at that in depth, and, you know, we talk about production credits. We talked about the state of Wyoming ensuring that we would have a market for the gasoline and doing some of those things. There's hedges that are available. Of course, I didn't want the state of Wyoming to be involved in hedging prices. I think that's a private citizen or private entity that should be doing that. But we looked at that, and nothing in this precludes that. If you look at the language, we've talked about other incentives. And so this is sort of a moving in target. And the main reason we came back to do the $10 million on the feed study is because we feel to get people to come to Wyoming, it's going to be the smaller entrepreneurial-type companies. $1.8 billion isn't small, but at least that would help them get here. The bigger projects, which are the $5 to $10 billion-type plants, would be built by major corporations that probably aren't interested in coming to Wyoming. And that's why we looked at the incentivization on the front end to get the feed study, but doesn't preclude looking at others, and the idea is if we get one and up and running, there might be more that would come to Wyoming.
So, okay, Mr. Chairman. So I was thinking these are already folks in Wyoming. You said getting folks to come to Wyoming. Did I hear you wrong? Or
no, Mr. Chairman, you didn't. There's one particular company that's in Wyoming looking at it. There's one that's moved to Wyoming recently that's going to look at it that has their base of operations here now. And as I understand it, the third one is someone that's outside the state but would come in here and locate here and build this facility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hurlis, Senator Bebout, let me take this to a completely different level and maybe have a bit of a discussion from kind of a philosophical point of view. You know, the Clean Coal Task Force was only created in 2007, and it was created specifically to secure Wyoming's financial future by preserving the value of coal. And what appears to me to be this is one of many erosions into that charge that is funded by AML funds, which are a tax on our state's coal industry. Our coal miners are being taxed to provide these resources. And now we see the coal industry really funding their competitors and falling by the wayside with all of these different things coming from the university, coming from this effort. Now we're even changing the name of the task force to dilute that even more. You know, anyway, I'm sure your committee has had some discussions along these lines. I haven't been privy to those. I'd like to hear some of how you came to this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're very, very aware of the importance of coal to Wyoming. And this isn't in any way, shape, or form an attempt to minimize the importance of coal or what the Clean Coal Task Force was set up to do. That doesn't change. That continues. And if you look at the language in here, we don't say natural gas, we say minerals. Coal's a mineral. And so you could have a coal. I mean, you have the DKRW moving forward as well, but it could be certainly a different type of coal, clean coal, that could qualify for this. In fact, I think one of the companies that's looking at it has a different kind of coal gasification process that they may be utilizing for this. So we're not trying to put natural gas against coal. That's not the idea at all. The main thing driving it is value added. And we do know that the gasoline is worth a lot of money when oil is at $100 a barrel relative to the price of coal and natural gas. And you can look at some of the charts, and if you see the differential in terms of spread between oil and coal and natural gas, you can see why this kind of a project makes sense, because the economics are there relative to the price differential. So it doesn't take away or try to compete natural gas against coal. It's a way to add value to those resources in our state, take advantage of the differential in price, and come up with a product that we're looking for, which is gasoline. I don't know if that answers your question. Rob, would you...
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would agree with the Senator that there is a clear understanding and I believe a commitment on the part of certainly the School of Energy Resources with respect to coal. I mean, and the legislature, as you well know, has allocated close to $30 million into that research fund, which has to be matched with projects. And if you look at the history of that, those projects through time have gotten, I think, better. I think the task force has moved from being research sensitive to requiring a business plan as part of those research projects to say, okay, if we fund this, how does this impact coal and particularly Wyoming coal, and I think that was also part of the reasoning behind the partnership with GE. That's a significant commitment, and even now we're trying to preserve at least parts of that with the DKRW and GE in talks about what might be done at their plant. So I think there's not a diminution of interest in coal at all. In fact, one of the cornerstones of the School of Energy Resources strategic plan is advanced conversion technologies, and part of the money that's requested in those AML funds is for the conversion. This happens to be another one that looks at conversion. So there is a clear understanding about the importance of converting coal long-term to higher value products. And so the problem is a lot of this stuff takes time, and the other problem is that these are very big projects. I mean, DKRW, they don't come, you can't kind of increment your way there. They come in really big packages. And so, and then the last thing I'll mention is Western Research Institute, that does an amazing amount of work with coal, probably has some of the best test facilities in the nation. One of the things that we're looking at is where the federal money was spent on coal research and where the coal came from, and those don't match up, as you know. Senator Byrd was very very successful in moving money to West Virginia and Pennsylvania to do coal research, and there's nothing literally west of the Mississippi, even though we supply the lion's share of coal. So that's a topic of conversation about how we kind of, we being the state with both the School of Energy Resources and Western Research Institute and the university all work together to place more focus on coal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just taking a quick glance at the governor's proposed budget reappropriation of AML, you know, it 42.25 million dollars taken directly away from the coal industry in sort of crude, blunt terms, and all redirected to CO2 pipeline, natural gas filling stations. I think, you know, for me to go back to my constituents and explain to them how and why these things are happening, and convincing them, if you will, that this is not a direct assault on their livelihood, is a bit of a challenge, quite frankly.
Discussion, and you know, when we go into the issue of the AML utilization, and I've already expressed my public concern that we've taken the AML dollars and putting them into highways as though they're general fund dollars. And from my colleagues from Gillette, here's what I'd say, and from a vantage point of one of your friends that's down in Albany County. Every year that I've gone through an election, I have half of my constituents complain that the mineral industry's not paying their share of taxes and that taxes ought to go up. And so if you're the coal industry and you were the entity that was paying for most of our taxes for many years, I'd suggest to you that were it not for natural gas volumes and gas prices and the taxes that have been now running the state where gas is king, if that hadn't been there, right now the coal industry would be paying more taxes. If we had deficits, I can assure you that there are more votes outside of Sweetwater County and Campbell County, and there's enough votes out there to drive up your severance taxes and all those taxes. So in this respect, the mineral industry is together in this, and it's in your interest that we keep a strong gas industry to share the cost of the load of this now $4 billion, $5 billion budget that we have And the last thing you need is for gas prices to hang down at $2, $1. You want them hanging high up there so that the eyes are looking towards that for taxation purpose. So we also know on our three-legged stool that we are so dependent on taxes from the mineral industry. The stronger the gas industry is, the more that they can either share or carry a substantial load off of their tax base. And so, but I think it's fair to say a couple things. One is the AML dollars, when we began using them, the notion was to either diversify the economy into other areas that will generate tax base to share the load of taxes with the mineral industry, or alternatively to build out the capacity for oil and gas. If you look at for every dollar of gas that we're getting from enhanced oil recovery, that's a dollar of tax we're not looking to the coal industry from. And my constituents think you're getting a free ride. I don't believe that, but they do. And there's a lot of folks out there that think that you ought to be doing more for the university or for the community or the schools. But and it's true that you're right now, it's your coal lease bonuses that are building our schools. When we lose those coal lease bonuses, who's going to pay for it? Are we going to institute an income tax? Probably not. If the residents of Wyoming get their chance, if it's a choice between an income tax or increasing severance tax, I kind of think I know what the answer will be. So, but I do believe that when you start pulling them out for highways to build what is a cost that we should be paying through taxes, you're no longer using these dollars for the exact purpose. So my answer when you go back to your coal companies is that we have just as much interest in keeping a robust natural gas mineral production to keep your taxes down and to increase our production. That's the easy answer. Going back to you, Eli, and to you, Rob, I guess the question is that I'd follow up on Representative Wallace's question, and that is, what more can we do for the coal industry? And I'm disturbed that we had set out to look at carbon sequestration. Now we find out that one company in the state has pretty much secured all the CO2 that's available. The gas producers have an insatiable, the oil guys have an insatiable desire for that CO2. And one of the casualties is going to be either a slowdown or a stop to the sequestration type of the project. What do we tell the coal guys? You're just going to have to wait till the CO2 is available. And then follow up in what are the other projects that we're doing to help the coal industry? And are there any requests for the coal research that we're turning down?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Rob could speak to the Clean Coal Task Force in terms of the project load on research and development. And as far as I'm aware of, that process and that they go through for the application and everything has been working. I know they turned some down. Everybody that comes to the Clean Coal Task Force now with a research idea, even though they have matching money, is not accepted. It's based on the merit and the potential of that research project to have merit down the road in terms of cash flow. I don't think that the coal industry, in terms of that part of it, feels like they're being left out at all. That's not what this is all about. What we're really talking about is value added. And Mr. Chairman, you make a good argument about the importance of natural gas. 65% of our tax base is from minerals. Of that, half is from natural gas. And we in Wyoming are so blessed with both. And we are the Minerals Committee. We're not the Natural Gas Committee. We're not the Coal Committee. We're the Minerals Committee. And we look at a balanced approach to help Wyoming and make a decision that's best for Wyoming, which I think is looking at these kind of adverse technology conversions that add value to these products we have. Is this available for the coal? Sure it is. And DKRW is moving forward, and we've already, and I think if I recall, the last couple of years, we've come forward with grants to help that particular project in different ways. And we're all very familiar with what's going on in terms of the bonding out there that's available by the state of Wyoming and some of the how wet their appetite is and what they're looking for and how we as a legislature may respond to that. So I've never really thought of this as one or the other. I thought of it as both. And I, you know, in Fremont County, you know, we have natural gas, we have oil, we used to have coal. And I just, you know, there's a lot of people that want to have coal compete against gas at national levels. I'm absolutely opposed to that. I think we move forward together. This is not a coal versus natural gas issue. It's what's best for Wyoming and our tax base and the jobs and what we want to try to do by adding value.
I'll tell you one thing. I share that Representative Wallace's concern that here we're doing a number of things in our budget to help gas companies. We helped for infrastructure for the Niobrara play that would have helped Chesapeake. We put in, we're being asked to put in money that's going to help Denbury. We've got money that's helping in Merritt. We've got every gas oil company is getting a piece of Wyoming's resources. And I tell you, it's a slap in the face to watch a commercial from the gas industry belittle the coal industry. And there's part of me that says if you're going to get state of Wyoming's money and you're going to be Chesapeake out doing ads about that are derogatory to the coal industry, why would we help them for one penny?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know the CEO who you're talking about with Chesapeake, and I'm very familiar with the comments. Do I like them? No, and I'm opposed to what he says, and he's tried to make an issue and compete with coal, and I don't agree with that.
Well, I guess we had a letter from county commissioners from, I think, Senator Meyer's district that suggests that Chesapeake wasn't paying its share on the roads and highways, and my view of it is that's the way they're going to be from now on. We won't help them. I mean, if you know him, you ought to let him know that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know him personally. I just know who he is and what he said, and I think that your comments are valid. I don't think it's a position for him to say some of the things he did about coal. I agree. There's room for both. There really is, and that's what we're trying to do with this.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond a bit to your comments and Representative Wallace with respect to carbon storage. First, I would like to give you a quick summary of what we have been working on through the Carbon Management Institute as part of the School of Energy Resource, and Ron Surdam runs that. And we completed a characterization well this summer to almost 13,000 feet, collected 910 feet of core. That well was paid for primarily or in substantially by winning competitive federal grants. We competed with everybody in the country for grants from DOE to drill that characterization well. We put some Wyoming money in it as well. And that's the first step in looking at commercial scale carbon storage. And so we completed that well. There's a lot of science being done still and will continue for the next probably year and a half. And when we saw, we were obligated under the legislation to report out, that was phase one of what turned out to be a three-phase project, two phases and a transition phase. We competed last spring for another DOE solicitation for what they call a small-scale injection, which they measured at 40,000 tons. And that was going to be our transition between this characterization well and then the full field development. We had an amazingly good proposal that we matched. We went to the ERC and got permission and money for our cost share on that. DOE said we've got $95 million. There's $11 million cap on these. We expect to fund 10 to 12 projects. And we, to my knowledge, we were the only one that met all the criteria that they laid out, the 40,000 tons. And part of that was the circumstance of being near Rock Springs and the CO2 pipeline. And so we could do that within a budget. And what happened, was they only committed $35 million, didn't even bother to tell us that we weren't successful. We had to find out through back channels. And they funded three projects, which when we look at the merit of them, it's beyond us. So anyway, we weren't successful there. But Ron and his group understood the price increase of CO2 plus the argument, not only the expense of CO2, but the argument of why would you take perfectly good CO2 that can generate EOR income and put it in the ground? I mean, we got that. And so and the political fight plus the liability issue of dealing with CO2 in underground storage and permits and insurance and things like that. So in conversations with industry and his own creativity, he said, you know, this doesn't have to mean the end of storage research. And so he came up with a plan that said, okay, for phase two, we can still do some work. We'll substitute water for CO2 because both are liquids. We have to calibrate things. You can't get everything done, but you can get a lot done for a whole lot less money. So that's the proposal we made, which I thought was extraordinarily bright. There was still trepidation, if you will, about moving forward, but I look at that in terms not so much giving up or abandoning storage, because even the folks in the EOR business who, when I was looking at my responsibility on that transition project, was to go find CO2, even the companies that told me, even if we had some, we wouldn't give it to you because we don't believe in this, after the conversation got rolling, said, listen, you know, there is a role in here that we might want to talk to you about for storage as a surge tank. In other words, the production flows for CO2 don't always match up with EOR injection flows. So having a cushion or a surge tank in there where you can put CO2 in the ground and then take it out later is of benefit to the EOR industry, let alone the coal industry long term for projects like that. So I think what we're looking at here is just dealing with a timing issue. And it looked to us like it was going to be swimming upstream and it was impossible at this point to go out and find huge amounts of CO2. And the other interesting thing in that conversation with the industry, there was a really important point made that was not lost on us. They asked us, what do you want to achieve? And we said, we want to end up with a certified commercial scale storage site. Not a well, but a whole certified commercial site. So they said, okay, you can either stay with these DOE big science projects, I think that's a direct quote, of just putting CO2 in the ground, looking at it, watching it, which there's value to. There's no question about that. Or you can think about this in the context of how a commercial company would. And what the commercial company would do is try to work down the risk, try to decrease the uncertainty with the least amount of money through time till you get to that point where you can say, okay, we're ready for a commercial storage. And the way one of their ideas was say, listen, you can use water because you can do a lot of pressure tests and all kinds of things like this for a lot less money, a lot less hassle with permitting and insurance. And so Ron, thinking about that, and his other folks came up with that degree. That plan, I mean, we have that on the shelf. We are in a position with that characterization well to revive this process fairly quickly. And so I think when money is available and perhaps we need more time to explain that to more folks so that they understand, and we need to go find match. I mean, that was the other condition of that money, was that we needed to go find match. And we did some of that, and we can certainly do some more. So I would say that if we look at the long term, And then the reason, one of the reasons why we started down getting interested in CO2 and storage and the legal framework and the regime for DEQ was that companies that were coming to us with coal projects in the prior administration, and they said, we have to know what's your CO2 policy. Now, granted, this was in the world of Lee Rubin Warner and climate change and all that stuff. But the point, I think, was still valid. And we would say, well, listen, you know, you should monetize that CO2 in the UR world. And they said, we get that. But what our bankers are telling us is we don't know how long EOR will last, and we need a fairly firm policy on what we can do with that CO2 before the bankers are going to write those billion-dollar checks. And so that's what was at the core of starting down this road. That, I think, is what's happened, which to our benefit, is the EOR potential is way bigger than we thought it was at the time. So that horizon may extend some. And it's also clear that we need probably to find some natural sources of CO2 if we're going to do that, because, as the chairman said, not all of the next increment of CO2 is necessarily going to end up producing Wyoming oil. That was the lesson of the Bighorn Basin RMP. There's somewhere between 800 million and 2 billion barrels of recoverable oil up there. And the BLM never even mentioned, I think there were two sentences in that whole document, in the draft EIS, about EOR, and their conclusion was you don't have a pipeline, you don't have any CO2, so you shouldn't have to worry about it. Well, those 2 billion barrels are worth about $11 billion at $70 oil and current tax rates to Wyoming, so we're not going to ignore that. We're going to try and accelerate that to the best of our ability. So, and that's a long-winded response, Representative Wallace, and I apologize for the length of that. But I wanted you to know that there are a lot of people still thinking about carbon storage and utilization and how that works in a scheme. And the process now, I think, is integrating that with EOR and understanding those things and seeing where they work together. But even in the context of EOR, with that kind of surge tank notion, storage is still important.
So that surge tank concept, thank you for that, because I learned a lot listening to you. The surge tank idea is at Rock Springs, but we're talking about the Bighorn Basin. You can have a surge tank that far away from the – that's not making sense to me, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, great point. Thank you for bringing that up. The current notion of going forward, which contemplates and that's the reason you see in the governor's budget some money for a CO2 pipeline network. Part of that is to answer the question you just posed, which is how does that surge tank work? But the other part of that CO2 pipeline network will be to look at smaller surge tanks, if you will, in the Powder River Basin and probably in the Bighorn Basin, because they'll be different. The Rock Springs uplift has unique geology that will, we believe, accommodate literally billions of tons of CO2. The inventory that's being done right now to look at how you can do that in the Powder River Basin will primarily probably be depleted oil and gas fields that are still sealed, which are great when we can identify those, because those will be proximate to coal. So the notion of a coal plant in the Powder River Basin that has available through the CO2 network and or a surge tank makes a great deal of sense in our mind. And so part of this is just making sure you have a long-term perspective and know where our values. And as Senator Bebout said, long term, it's about conversion, it's preparing to be able to do the conversion. And I think the other thing is preparing for mandates, if you will, that may hit us faster than we want, where we're going to have to deal with stuff. So we haven't forgotten about it, and we're working on it, and I think it's you'll see requests come forward in future years to flush out that plan.
And Mr. Chairman, the only thing I would add to that, and it's a timing issue, Representative Wallace, just like Rob was talking about, and the feeling of the Minerals Committee as we look at today, 2012, where can we best spend limited resources to get the greatest benefit to the state? Done a lot of good work there, and ultimately that'll be something that we can move forward. But the EOR potential just exceeded a lot of our, a lot of people's thoughts on that, and that's where any CO2 we can find within our state, there's huge demand. Not the Bighorn Basin, the millions of barrels there, the Powder River Basin. So that's something that could really enhance the production of oil for a long time, and we haven't given up on carbon management. It's and then the other thing, all the legislation we did for sequestration, I think was very, very beneficial, because we are the largest coal producing state in the country.
I recognize in that I've disclosed to you all that I've had lots of conversations with folks about these issues and trying to wrestle through them. I thought I'd just ask some questions to give you all some thoughts that I've had. But if you look at the DKRW model, we first allocated dollars for the road up in Carbon County. Now we're talking about issuing two different kinds of bonds, industrial development bonds, some other some tax-exempt bonds, where we will not offer the credit of the state. We simply offer our status as a state to issue the bonds. And the notion is that since we're the issuing authority, the bonds, either because of their tax status or just being the state saying, hey, this is a good idea, it attracts investors that DKRW might not otherwise get. There's that. There's obviously making inquiry whether we'll be direct investors or direct lenders to the project. But one of the things that we've now met with DKRW for the last couple of years is, even if we only have a small amount of participation, DKRW has consistently said having the state in as a role in some capacity helps them attract other investors and interest in the project, because there seems to be some belief in the world that if the state of Wyoming is interested in it, that makes it easier to track, to cause and commit investment. And I guess in going to the this new gas to liquids, if you take DKRW as an example, DKRW paid for all of their initial FEED studies themselves. They come to us at a stage where they needed us at a different time, at a time where the European debt markets are collapsing. They're having a hard time getting money, but they still need our help. My sense of it is what the gas to liquids people are saying is, and I think, Eli, you alluded to it, is that there is likely to be gas to liquids investments in the United States, but it's going to be on the Gulf Coast, where they have more natural gas, they have more labor, a variety of different environments, and the notion is that if you're going to attract the level of investment you need to get to a development stage, the state of the Wyoming has a role in participating with these folks, because that attracts more money. Is that what you're hearing, and do you think it has any merit?
Mr. Chairman, I can only relate to what's been presented to me from other parties, and that has a huge part of it. The fact that the state of Wyoming is willing to step up in terms of endorsing these projects, but also doing more than just putting a blessing on and saying we like it, with their possibility of bonding, possibility of this type of a project with the advanced conversion technology and a grant for the FEED study. And Mr. Chairman, I was thinking about this thing because I thought about these very questions in this whole debate, and I was looking at the Wyoming, and I would say in the 60s, you know, we were just getting started with the coal, and we all remember the to our benefits, the mistake Montana made with their high severance tax, and that huge mistake they made allowed us to have what we have today. But we also did, and I think it was probably under Governor Hathaway, and he recognized, along with probably the legislature, that, you know, we ought to do something more than shipping our coal out when this thing develops, and that is to try to have power plants. And what we did back then, and we had some incentives, we did pollution control equipment. We did different things to convince people to come here and build a power plant, because obviously when we built the power plants here, we had to find the transmission to get the electrons out, so it wasn't like we had the market here. And I look at this in some ways, the DKRW with the actual coal to liquids, the natural gas to liquids that we're potentially looking at, I look at this as an area, a new industry that might just catch on, and I think it's money well vested to try to see if we can attract those investors to come here and spend their money here. With the state being behind it, helps. The whole world is on the teetering edge with this, what's going on with the markets and financing and everything, and it's difficult, and so anything we do, and within reason, and I know that the number that was put out there by DKRW was a number that didn't excite me at all, and I was not in favor of their initial numbers. But to have the state somehow involved probably does make sense at a level that we're comfortable with.
Well, I think, you know, if you take liquids, there's companies like Sasol, large companies who do this in the world, who have their attention to Wyoming. They don't need our help to do it, but they're not doing it. There would be no project advanced this far except for a group of folks, DKRW, so it seems to me for every dollar, whether they get there, they're more likely to get there than some large company who's already said, and I think Sasol and the companies doing gas to liquids have already said, if we do it, it's not going to be in Wyoming. So at some point, if we're going to want to have these companies be here and develop jobs and consume our gas, pay taxes, there is an investment. And what is that investment? For me, you go back to the same issue. Look at what we're receiving in oil and gas revenues, our taxes, and coal, and measure. These are pretty small investments compared to what we're taking off of them in taxes. Eli, the other thing that...
Mr. Chairman, could I comment on that real quick? Like, and this discussion reminds me of 1988 and 1989 in the state of Wyoming, when revenues were certainly much bleaker than this, and we recognized that there was no takeaway capacity for a natural gas, and we embarked on a process to set up bonding capacity to try to build pipes from southwestern Wyoming to Kern County, California, to then use our natural gas to fire the steam heaters to get the oil out of the ground in Kern County, California. And it was very similar. Why would we risk Wyoming's money? Why would we do these things? What is this all about? And fortunately, the legislature moved that forward, set up the bonding capacity that sparked the interest of investors in the private sector. Then Governor Sullivan promoted our state, promoted our natural gas, and we at that particular time in the late 80s had like 1.5 BCF takeaway capacity in our state. Now we have 7 or 8 BCF capacity to take away our gas to the other markets. If we didn't have that, all this natural gas with no markets wouldn't do us any good. So very similar debate, Mr. Chairman, back then. And look at the benefits. Not saying that this is going to have the same benefits, but at least we're looking at things that might have those kind of benefits.
Eli, when I go back and think about the having lived through the Char Fuels, K-Fuel projects and the criticisms that came out of that, I think looking back, that the biggest criticism is that we lent money. Obviously, that was a little bit different. We gave them interest-free loans. They used the loans to go out and buy zero-coupon bonds, but ultimately they took millions of dollars of interest off, no benefit. But part of what we learned in that is if all you're doing is funding an entity to pay salaries, that's what they'll do. They'll pay salaries, and then today the salaries are gone, there's no product. And so the question I have is that if you look at, you know, with the DKRW project, what we're saying, we said, look, we'll put $10 million in roads. Now we're talking about making investments. But the trigger is that we'll put the money in when you're prepared to sink $1.8 billion in it. And so even if there's a bankruptcy, even if things don't go well, we still have $1 billion worth of investments in the state. And in many instances, you could put $100 million of investment as a state into a facility. Heaven forbid they don't have to do a bankruptcy, but if they did, presumably the facility will continue to operate, continue to provide jobs, and we could still see a benefit. So there's a real difference there. Now, when you come back to the gas to liquids project, they're saying, look at our FEED study, which is sort of part of the business plan, if you will. I think it's important to a site. It's dependent upon certain licensing technologies that might be out there. And the before you even get to the question of whether or not we get a benefit from the product, the question is are we paying for a product or are we just paying for wages to some folks that want to come here and take our money?
Well, Mr. Chairman, those are good points, and I recall the char fuels and the K fuels and all the debate, and that was when I was first in the legislature. This is really a different situation, mainly because one of the differences, that was ideas that had not been proven, and it was more conceptual things. This is where technology exists, and the money will be going. Will be going to salaries. The salaries will be to divide if this thing goes forward for the FEED study, which will be paying engineers, be paying people to develop the cost and the model to be able to see if the economics work. So, in that sense, it's going to that. If this committee wanted to say that these shall not pay salaries of the companies bringing forth this project, I'm comfortable with that. We're not setting this up to pay salaries for the particular company that wants to get the money for a FEED study. The FEED study goes to the engineering firm that will design it and move it forward. This is not about putting salaries into the companies that come and apply for grants.
As much as I'd like to see at least one engineer get paid, that's not what this money's for. And I think when we do the final 300, it's one thing if you're – I think the idea is that what you want to do is pay for a third party, an engineering product, and that we're not paying for – or the investors – well, let me go there. With respect to the investors that the company's coming in, are you going to allow them to do in-kind match to the $10 million, or do they have to put in cash to – so you got $20 million of cash?
Mr. Chairman, the devil's in the detail on the RFP based on what the Clean Coal Task Force comes up with. Our thoughts all along had been it was not going to be in-kind in the sense that they would go out and find partners that would contribute cash. Now, that cash could be in the form of, like, there's certain technologies for gasification that exist. They have proprietary rights and costs associated with that. If they brought that to the table, that might constitute some in kind if you had to go buy it. And I can't tell you for sure how that might work, but it was set up to be cash in kind to the extent that it wouldn't be like the particular company that would put the application and they would say that half of this is our own salary, that's our contribution. That was not the case or not the indication of our discussion.
Well, that's so going back to the concepts that Senator Owen Flatter and discussed, the first issue is if we're putting money in, we're going to end up with a deliverable, a product that has value. And the second, and to do that, I think the restriction is that we want to match in kind. I don't know that in kind labor makes a difference, but it has to be a cash or cost incurred investment towards and then a deliverable, but as I understand it, the FEED study is a $20 million FEED study. It's not a $10 million FEED study. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that's the number that's been presented to us, and that's the whole purpose of it. That's the cost that they anticipate to get that third party to provide that FEED study.
Well, I think if we want to avoid the type of criticism that we ran in the old that previous experience on the Constitutional Amendment 4 type projects or whatever it was, we need to make sure that we're getting a deliverable and that we're matching cash, and that's something we ought to talk about. Then, as I understand it, going also to Senator Von Flatern's comments is that these feed studies, I mean, ultimately, if you go to somebody like Idaho National Labs, they take site-specific information, they take licensing information, they take a business model. So if this is built, for example, in the Rock Springs Basin or over in that area, the product that's delivered is good for a gas project in that area. It's not something you just take over and say, let's put it in the Powder River Basin. Is that, do I understand that right?
Mr. Chairman, I think there are specific site conditions that would have to be part of that. And to a question that Representative Stewart had posed earlier about educational benefits, I mean, one of the things, depending on how you do the scoping, and I think the state would have a legitimate right to be at the table to say, okay, we want some of this information for our benefit in the future and have some agreement. I think it would be pretty beneficial to have actual numbers on an actual project that could, that we could learn from, both at the School of Energy Resources and other places, that if we had access and knew that. I mean, there are, what will fall out of a feed study will be descriptions and recommendations about labor, about manufacturing capacity, transportation issues when you're talking about large vessels that you'll need and all kinds of things like that. Those would all, it would be very useful, I think, for the state to start gathering that understanding so as we go forward, we just get smarter through time about doing our own feasibility. And I think the way the chairman has set this up so that there's opportunity for a professional, what in the business called an owner's engineer or a banker's engineer, that looks at that with a hard-nosed, cold light of day to say, okay, is this really worth doing? And bringing that kind of recommendation back to the Advanced Conversion Task Force. And those folks are they're business people, and some of them have done plants, and they know this. And what we know from the discussion of the first iteration is they get the notion of advanced conversion. No question about that. They're on board with that. They understand and appreciate and support incentives. No question about that. The only question is what form that incentive takes. And I think what senators come up with is a pretty intriguing notion.
I mean, then as I see it, the advantage of saying we'll match cash for cash is that you're not essentially paying salaries of promoters to come in and promote and then walk away with the cash. Going back to the Kate or the Char Fuel situation, where the only folks that may have benefited were the chairman or the president of the company and the stockholders. So here you say, look, the only thing that you can get out of this project is the feed study. We're not going to pay your salaries, and the only way you get the feed study is if you put in $10 million and we put in $10 million. So that means that we put in the $10 million, we know we're getting a deliverable that has some value. Now, I guess the next question is, to the extent that, as you say, that some of this, the deliverable will have value at any facility, how are you going to go about making sure that if you've got three candidates or if you do an RFP, you got four or five candidates, that the successful candidate doesn't say, this has been great information, and what we've really learned is the best place to do this is on the Gulf Coast. Thank you very much.
What does this mean, Rob?
That's above my pay grade.
Yeah, that's what I use. Well, the intellectual property side of this is something that would be certainly considered, and that value of that, if the state's putting up the $10 million and the other people come up with the $10 million cash to go out and secure that feed study, I think we have to say that we have ownership of that. And that has value, and we will have that to take this technology and go somewhere else after we've been compensated for that in a way, shape, or form that we think. We went through this with the GE project, the overriding royalties or the patent protection we had or whatever. I'm not sure how the university finally negotiated that. I had concerns about that as well. Ultimately, if they come here, we spend the money, we have the actual intellectual property, and they decide to pay us whatever it's worth and go somewhere else, Mr. Chairman, there's nothing we can do about that. I really think that the niche we're finding, though, is a smaller entrepreneurial-type companies that want to do it in Wyoming at the scales we're talking about, where this kind of incentive program makes sense to them. When you mentioned Sasol in Africa, they're not going to come to Wyoming and do this because they're going to go other places for other reasons, and we're looking at a different kind of niche.
Well, what I'm looking for in the RFP that I don't see is that, the beauty of DKRW is by the time they got in here, they were launched on our sites. We didn't have to ask them, are you committed or are you going somewhere else? They were well beyond. I mean, if they've got $50 to $60 million of FEED studies that are really only valuable for Carbon County, Wyoming, that's easy to see. When you start at a more emphasis stage that we are now, it seems to me then that in the authorization for the RFP, you ought to be asking, have you, what's your commitment to Wyoming? What's your presence here? What have you had other successful projects in Wyoming? Do you have the ability to command access to financial markets? But there are some other things that would. My concern is if you, first of all, you have at least one Wyoming company looking at it. You've got everybody else. You need to have more criteria in the beginning and authorized to ask for so that you can discriminate for whatever you get. I think if we're going to do this, we ought to come up with those factors that we think would be fair basis for discriminating for people that we think will stay in Wyoming, do the project here, and do exactly what DKRW is doing now, and that is you hang in there and you bring the investment and you bring the ship, land the ship here.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that might be considered that is used sometimes in economic development programs and things like that. It's called a clawback. The studies that we have done, the Rentec study, the underground coal gasification study in particular, we got smarter, we being the state. And so in the case, I think, of the underground coal gasification study, which was about $500,000, as I recall. There's a provision in that, it was a cost share, that if a plant is built in Wyoming, we get to recover some or all of that study. It seems to me that you could, and this would be a pretty interesting test in the beginning, to say, are you willing to sign a contract that says if you don't build that in Wyoming, and take that FEED study someplace else, you pay for the part before we release that. You pay us back if you're going to go to Louisiana.
I guess my last question is that some disappointment now that essentially 10 or 15 years after we really narrowed down WR, Western Research Institute, that now we're doing all these FEED studies at Idaho National Labs, at these other places. Is that just the way it is, or are we ever going to be able to redevelop that type of expertise in Wyoming? How do you get that fundamental engineering back here?
Mr. Chairman, I think we have really good scientists at Western Research. Mostly they work at the pilot scale. I mean, we have in that advanced technology center just north of town there, there's an amazing array of gasification technology out there, and we're adding to it. In fact, I think there's within a month there'll be another pilot-scale gasifier that was funded partially by the Clean Coal matching funds. And so I think that through time you could probably develop that engineering capability, but But oftentimes, it's not the engineering. I mean, there are places that do the engineering. It's that owner's engineer's or banker's engineering perspective on the financeability and the risk assessment of the technologies or the combinations of those that there people are going to write checks based on their judgment of those projects and big checks. And so that's why I think you want really qualified folks there. Can we develop that expertise over time? Probably. But, I mean, it's a long pull.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just my observation would be if you try to compare WRI to INL, you really got apples and oranges. I think the level of competence and what we've accomplished based on what we have available to us as tools at WRI, they're getting the job done. INL, if you start out with $1 billion a year, 5,000 employee federal budget, things change in perspective, and they're able with that kind of money to hire pretty much anybody they want to, and then with their, and I'm not sure the mechanism of it, but they allow them to go outside and do other things independently, and that's where we've used INL because of this agreement they have with these scientists that they work for INL, but yet they're able to do these other things on some kind of a cost share. And it's a different situation than we're able to do with WRI. But yet I think given what we have to compete with and how we do a very good job of it. Back to the Wyoming thing, too, Mr. Chairman, and we tried to do that in this language, and we didn't get to the point that I would feel comfortable with probably after listening to you, but we just emphasize Wyoming. We talk about Wyoming. It's for Wyoming. It has to make sense for Wyoming. I mean, it's all driven about Wyoming. That's an intriguing idea to say, okay, we'll do this. If this thing really comes to fruition, there should be a payback to get our $10 million back. You know, that's certainly... That would, to me, would be on the table.
Yeah, I believe it's probably a process that needs to happen, and I think it's profitable. But just looking at the internet here, there's a couple of things that I'm assuming that we're not going to use the Fisher, hang on, tropes,
Fisher tropes.
Tropes, because that's old technology. Looking at Synfuels here international, they say they can do a barrel for $25. And you're lucky to get a barrel under the Fisher tropes for $35. These guys have been running a plant since 2005 down in Dallas, Texas, and I just don't want us to reinvent the wheel. So I'd say, you know, if we get an opportunity, give this Kenneth Hall at Synfuels International a call down in Dallas. It sounds like they're selling licensing to Kuwait to build a plant there now. And so we might be able to buy the license for Synfuels International for, you know, and these might be already engineered, ready to go plants. So I'd say, you know, we can move forward on this, but I think it might be that maybe you can buy a turnkey engineering project for less than $20 million with new technology. So I'd say, you know, let's take a little bit of, I guess, due diligence to find out whether we don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Fisher Tropes was that's how World War II, and that's
right,
what Germany
Nazis,
did to get
yeah.
their diesel. I mean, it's been around forever. It still works. It's not as economical as others.
Yeah.
I know that I believe it's ExxonMobil has developed a gasification process that they're licensing. I think the DKRW may be looking at that in their plant. That's certainly a possibility if you should have a natural gas to liquids plant as well. That would be the gasification process you would use. But that technology is available, and it's part of the licensing agreement, which – as you do your FEED study, that's part of what the engineers will come up with.
Yeah, and it's not a slam dunk that this article said that BP tried it on the North Slope, spent $86 million, and walked away from it.
Mr. Chairman, we were familiar with BP's project up there, and they had a 300-barrel-a-day plant with a certain technology that they were looking at licensing. And it's interesting that their whole operation and scientific part of it is in London, and yet the project they chose was in Alaska. And the reason, and we asked, why did they choose Alaska? And it was because the state of Alaska expressed interest and support.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I wanted to build on some of your comments. Of course, early on we found out DKRW's needs were for some roads. Public infrastructure, roads coming in from both ends, and we're going to address that. As recently as last year, to build on that, when we were looking at data centers, what were the needs for the immediate issue at hand? What was on the table? And it was infrastructure again. And we get a lot of support for that. And that public benefit, this is where I just keep coming back to. And again, looking at the history, Mr. Chairman, we have a long history of using loans or bonding capacity for when it's for economic development, when that's the where we're going to hang our hat, instead of using our taxpayers' dollars to build these public-private partnerships, which it appears to me, Mr. Chairman, that this is where we're headed with this. And I guess my question, how do you feel about that, Mr. Chairman, Bebout, that do you feel that we're getting into some sort of a partnership that at some point we might look back and say, well, maybe that wasn't the best idea. Maybe we ought to stay with running the government instead of getting into some kind of a process like this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's the fine line you draw between, you know, I'm a private sector kind of guy and I would like to see everything done in the private sector, but the real world now that we live in and operate in is that there's incentives and different states are competing for the same thing. What makes this intriguing to me is what Wyoming has to offer relative to other states in this type of a situation is the vast resource we have called minerals. You know, people all around this country are looking enviously at Wyoming, and not only because of our physical nature and the way we do our budget, but also the tremendous wealth we have and the opportunities we have to move forward. So I would suggest to you that I think as a state where we get most of our money from the minerals, anything we can do at the best decision level prudently that we can make to take some of that money and put back in to grow the state in terms of jobs and value added makes sense. Is it risk-free? Absolutely not. And I get back to the Kern River thing. There were so many concerns about we put all this money and these bonds into a pipe that goes nowhere, just like the bridge that goes to nowhere. Well, the reality of it is if the state's behind it and you promote it properly, things happen and private sector moves forward. And by us elevating the support of Wyoming to this kind of project, it could very well be that the private sector does decide to come to Wyoming because we've elevated and they understand the potential there, and they say, you know, we're not going to go through all these loops and things that you require to get a lousy $10 million to them and do it anyway. So there's that trade-off. I think the ultimate thing that we need to do is let people know that we're looking at these kind of things, we're behind it, and yes, we are willing to step up, but not only with more than just lip service, but we're providing these kind of incentives to do it. And how far do you go and where do you go? That's kind of the Minerals Committee has looked at this. Is it $1 million? Is it $10 million? And based on our best guess, a $20 million study was the one that would make this kind of plant work. And we thought, well, if we're going to do 20, they ought to put up $10 million cash, and we ought to do 10. And at least at that point, we're moving forward together.
Look at your Craig report. And the notion that we take a risk, we have at any given time, you know, $4 or $5 billion worth of revenue at risk. And sometimes doing nothing is riskier than, and if you peel off a percentage to reinvest to produce your minerals, so part of it is that if we do nothing, will private sector come and will they be here? And the difficulty, and one of the things that these folks have done is that you get on the Internet and you look at companies that are looking at these types of investments. In almost all instances, the large companies are looking at other areas of the United States for a variety of reasons, because of the labor force, because of access to larger volumes of gas than even that we have on the Gulf gas. Access, you look at potential investments in the Bakken where they don't have any gathering lines. We put a lot of gathering lines together, and now they've got all that vetted gas, so they've got an interest. So we are competing. And you're not only competing with the technology, but you're competing with the first investment infrastructure. Where is it going to go? And the risk of sitting back and doing nothing is the risk that North Dakota says to the same people, We'll give you $20 million, and then they spend their $1.8 billion in North Dakota. Or the Gulf states say, look, come down here, we'll give you $100 million, and they put their first investment there, and we've lost that investment and the potential that that investment, I mean, if you get a gas conversion facility and drive your natural gas, you drive up or drive down your storage and pick up demand, and you're now at $3 an MCF. We just paid it three times. So there comes a time where the risk of doing nothing is you look back and you have to at least put each risk equation into your analysis. Any other questions? Eli, thanks. I think that folks, why we got Eli here, you might look at your list of items if you want to know any more about the minerals. You've got the, you guys are in large part spearing the other couple investments in the governor's budget for I'll refresh my mind if I find my sheet here. You got your,
The chairman talking about the SER.
Right, we've got the SER projects, the energy partnership matching funds. You got the carbon dioxide pipeline network. You've got the continued operations of SER. The 24 point, the 10 and 10, and it may be that folks, if you want to ask Rob here, Rob may be the state expert on this. So if you have questions about that, this would be a good opportunity to get those questions answered.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I was just looking at the prior balance funds appropriation history. Was a handout we got, and it trying to refresh my memory. So we have the School of Energy Resources Strategic Areas of Concern for $10 million. Then we have the School of Energy Research Energy Partnership for another $10 million. And then I was also looking online at SER's website and the Coal Technology Task Force's website, and I can see, you know, all these research projects that were done in 2010, but then it just, like, stops. Are there no research projects going on now? Or are the current research projects being folded into some of these other things? Where's that at?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the funding source for that was the legislature's allocation of funds through several years. And the way that worked is after the allocations were made, then the Energy Resource Council was appointed to be the Clean Coal Task Force to evaluate the proposals. So the way the way that worked is there would be an announcement, a request for proposal that would go out, and then people would respond to that. And those research projects would be evaluated. Of course, that was matching funds, so they had to bring their own money to the table, and it couldn't be other federal funds straight up. So there was some things we had to do to make sure that worked out. A lot of those projects are kind of multi-year projects. So the money was allocated over those years through the legislature to the Clean Coal Matching Fund totaled, I think, about a little over $30 million. And most all of that was put up or was used in those proposals, but not every year, even though many years there were way more projects than were approved. So that's why I say that set of folks took their responsibility seriously, and they didn't have they wanted a return a potential return for the state long term. And so if a project didn't look like it had met that criteria, they wouldn't fund it. And so there is a lag time, if you will, between the time those projects were approved and we will get the final report. So there's still a fair amount of work underway. But the source of that money was the legislative allocation to the Clean Coal Task Force. And that's not in, there is not a allocation this year for that. So which is why you see it come to a halt, if you will. Does that make sense? If I get it answered for you?
Not exactly. Are there research projects going on now? Is there funding available for research projects ongoing?
Mr. Chairman, there is research ongoing. It is funded but not completed yet by the researchers, if that makes any more sense.
We have a standard budget allocation of about $10 million a biennium to go into those research projects. Is that right?
I don't, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if that's true or not.
Mr. Chairman, this started before I got involved in the Senate, but it's a year-by-year Section 300 series appropriation, as I understand it. And the money has been utilized, and I think it's $30 million. And the number that comes to my mind looking at the report is there's money left that has not been allocated yet. So there's ongoing research projects in place. There's others that are doing, and there's some that went so far and backed off and decided not to go any further. I can give you a complete report. We received a report from that Clean Coal Task Force last fall that really spells everything out, where the money's gone, what kind of projects. It's very well done. It'll tell you everything you want to know. And, Rob, could you get that for Representative Wallace, and she can look at that?
What happened on that coal research legislation, former Representative Simpson and I brought a bill to create the task force, and actually we started off and said, I had just gone down to a research facility in Alabama that was researching different types of coal processing, and largely funded by the federal government, and right next to the Southern Company's facility. And ironically, all the coal that was sitting on the outside was PRBC coal, and all these trains down there. I said, it makes no sense. But what ends up happening is those research projects, what I discovered is, so if you're sitting there and you've got a research facility in Alabama, you have access to the Southern companies to pay for your research, and the Southern company has access to $25 million customers to collect taxes on and then put in the research. So we're sitting up here, and we've got this distant site. So my proposition was 5 cents a ton, we'll tax the coal, and we'll put into coal research in Wyoming. Probably in Laramie. But we'd have research facilities here or in Gillette. Didn't make any difference. 5 cents a ton, all of a sudden, that drew the attention of the coal lobbyists, and they said, no way, you can't tax us. So then we put in $10 million instead into a fund to start these coal projects. And, I still think it's a no-brainer to put 5 cents a ton tax on coal that's going to get paid by 25, 30 million customers somewhere else in the United States, and we have the premier research facility here. But what we've done is said we refuse to tax ourselves for that purpose, and all of the real money generated from our coal is at the end of the rail spurs or rail lines. That's where the real money comes in, and they've got plenty of money to do the research. And so I guess a couple of things. There is a way to make ourselves the premier coal industry, and it wouldn't even cost us any money. Having said that, I thought we had an ongoing commitment to about $5 to $10 million a year of coal research.
Mr. Chairman, in 2007, the appropriation was $2.5 million, 2008, 3.8, 2009, 10.6, 2010, 14 million. and then the interest from the 07 of 460 for a total of $31,377. And through the 6 years of obligations, obligated $25.5 million, which, of course, needed a match. So that's $51 million is going towards clean coal research. We have a remaining balance when this report was submitted to the Minerals Committee of $5.8 million in that account.
And we have no regeneration. Was that all AML funding?
Mr. Chairman, I can't tell you.
Well, I think maybe one of the things that we, if that's down to $5 million and there's no regeneration dollars, I think Representative Wallace has a point. Maybe we ought to make a commitment to say, go ahead.
Well, I'm wondering if on this sheet it shows 5.2 being redirected out of clean coal technology. Is that the remaining balance, and now we're down to nothing?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, what the governor did there. Rob, I'll leave that up to you. I don't work for him.
We'll find out. We'll find out.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd prefer that. I think I know the answer, but I don't want to.
I'll tell you what, Rob. Would you find the answer out, get it back to us, and then talk to the, I think our commitment is to continue that coal research and talk to the, I guess it would be your boss, your surrogate boss, I guess, and make sure that we have a level, identify that coal commitment and make sure it continues.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I would add to that is when we had the Clean Coal Task Force and all of that, we heard no one came to us and requested any kind of funding mechanism, and I guess maybe the Minerals Committee should have been asking those questions. There was nobody that was looking for that or asking for money, and we just never dealt with it. But I think your idea of it continuing, I certainly have no problem with that. There's a lot of, if you look at the list of projects and you can see the kind of things they're doing, they could have huge impacts on the ability for coal to be utilized, to be continued to be utilized for electrical generation, which is huge for our country.
You've got Ron Harper with Arch, or with, not with Arch, but
Basin.
With Basin, who is coal. They've got three or four coal consumers in there. So, and I know that, so let's find, if you would find out more about what's happening, are the grant request dying off? If so, why? But I go back to the notion that we were doing all this carbon sequestration project that Ron, you were putting so much effort in, and not, as far as I know, Arch, not a single coal company came up to do a matching, to significant matching. And that, I don't know what to make of that. It's a little bit disappointing, but it also suggests that that's not where they're putting their research dollars in, and yet the gas guys are putting money in. And we're getting a return on the investment, which is helping the coal industry indirectly. So,
Mr. Chairman, just to maybe give you a little idea of what we were seeing, too, is what we were hearing from the coal companies, and maybe this is a little bit of why we didn't have them coming and asking to continue these, is they're just under such a huge attack by the EPA with the far-reaching rule regulation they're doing through the Federal Register, that this has been the focus of what they're doing. And, of course, the committee as well, you know, looking at the clean air, greenhouse gases, and all the different things that they're doing to coal. So maybe that's just been such a huge, important part of it, and the shift has been there. And that's certainly what the committee heard when we talked to the coal companies, and Rob was there. That was what we were hearing from coal companies. How can we take on particularly the EPA with the clean air and greenhouse gases and what they're doing to the power plants? How can we help you as a state fight that battle? And we've really, really tried to do that.
Mr. Chairman, just to comment that, you know, certainly I'm seeing the investments the railroads are making in their coal corridors, and they're even experimenting with locomotives run on natural gas. Right here in Wyoming, they put in a new coal line to haul coal out of the Powder River Basin to bring loads out up there in Senator Meyer's area. They put a new siding so they could meet, empties could meet loads, because it was just a one-way coal line. And they named that siding after Senator Meyer there. So well, I say it to you anyway, a good senator from LaGrange. We call that citing Meyer. So right there where we're talking to the dispatchers on the trains, they'll say, meet at Meyer. And I never would have thought that they'd haul those coal trains out of there at the tonnage they're doing. They're doing distributive power trains out of there at about 18,000 tons a train. So it's pretty impressive what they're doing there.
So we want to take maybe natural gas and turn it into gasoline, and why don't we just, for a transportation fuel, I'm sure you, I guess that's probably in all the cost curves you talked about. Just the governor's got another proposal that this committee actually started with natural gas as a transportation fuel. And I guess it's all about dollars and cents, and you've looked at that certainly, but maybe we do all the above. Maybe that's the strategy, but thank you. As a comment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there's any other questions or anything the Minerals Committee can do, we'll stand by to do what we can.
That's it. We're gone.
Good rough things.
Gone the whole time. We show up to wrap her up. So it's good. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted, I sent you all out an email, and I had, I think that's good. I just wanted to let you guys know that all of the struggle we've been having, we're free and clear because Jim Hackett, who's the CEO of Anadarko, says that natural gas is going to $6. So I don't know if you guys want to just redo the Craig right now and price that in, or it says in the near future. Yeah, and he says this $2 is uneconomical, and it will only last for a short period of time, and in the near future to be more than $6 in an increasing number of energy companies stop drilling. Anyway, so I don't know if you guys want to start over or how we want to do this, but I thought I'd leave that out there.
We're rebasing now. Then we'll have more money. Okay. Steve, I don't remember why we even had you back, so remind us why you're here and what are we supposed to be doing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you had a series of questions and asked us to prepare answers to those questions at our first hearing, and the answers to those questions are in this binder, I think, was just passed out to you today, so obviously you haven't had a chance to look at it. And we're prepared to go through it in any amount of detail that you all are interested in. You know, you also, we informed you when we were here before about we had hired a consultant to look at our investment program and give us some ideas about in comparisons to other peer funds as to what we might look at and be looking at and need to improve our investment program in the near future. And Mr. Chairman, I guess the one item about the budget that you did ask us to work with A&I on, and I believe perhaps that's been passed out. I'm not sure whether it has or not. I think it has. That's a one-pager that they did. Remember, you asked us to break out our investment team into a separate budget organization and for your consideration when you work the budget, so that you could keep track of it, and we have a couple of comments on that. So,
well, why don't you start going through, ask your questions, and then
you comment. Sure, Mr. Chairman, and that I think Tom's prepared to walk you through those. We'll try and be as quick as we can. I know you're.
Well, we'll try to avoid that, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman. There were a series of questions, as Mr. Summers has suggested. The first one relates to the numbers of funds that are continuing to employ an 8% assumed investment return. And I believe if you were to go to page three, in fact, of the report, the very first major areas is assumptions for investment return. You know, a number of people have questioned whether or not the 8% continues to be appropriate. And I think that's certainly quite legitimate query. But here's a study that was published by the National Association of Retirement Administrators in 2011, looking at 126 public funds and showing those that have 8%, greater than 8% or less than. And of those illustrated, 70 of the 126 funds have 8% or greater. I think that this doesn't preclude almost all organizations taking a look at the appropriateness of the current assumed investment return, as are we. When you go down to the next, to the bottom of that page, it alludes to certain modeling that we asked our investment consultant to do, looking at our current portfolio. And that's it would be helpful if I were to add my glasses here, but in attachment number two. If you're looking under attachment number two, there is a capital markets projection of the WRS asset allocation for the next 30 years, both 5 to 7 year assumptions and 30 year assumptions. And what it's suggesting based on our current allocation is that over the 30 year time span, we'd be looking at about a 7.8% assumed investment return.
Now, you know, that's very meaningful to us. I have a couple of comments to make. One, of course, is that these capital market assumptions change and can change fairly markedly on an annual basis. For example, the 2012 assumptions compared to the 2011 ones are decreased by between 15 and 150 basis points. Another observation would be that the 7.8% expected return assumes no active management, no decisions on behalf of the investment team. So if we were to have the monies allocated just as they are today and leave them that way, if these assumptions are borne out, we'd have about a 7.8% return over the 30 years. I think 30-year assumptions are particularly, questionable, but we have to work with something. We rely on them for our projections. But I would suggest that they could change pretty markedly, as they have changed even over the last 5 years. We do have an investment team that's responsible for modifying the investments within the targets that the board has set. So we do engage in active management and do add value through the decisions that they make, taking advantage of, say, less efficient markets and the like. We have expectations that we're going to change our asset allocation. It's a work in progress. In fact, there are some asset classes that we don't even have represented that we've been working with our board to make available to us. For example, most public pension funds, certainly of our size, have employed private equity to some degree, and I think there are some significant opportunities for some small segment of our portfolio in that area. And that's an asset class that provides superior returns, or at least potentially can if you get the right managers, et cetera. So the 7.8%, while is the long-term projection, could change dramatically next year, depending upon what will actually happen, but it's anybody's guess. I think there are a lot of folks who would suggest it's going to be lower than that, and some even feel because of some of the adjustments in economies both here and Europe, that while the near term might be difficult, that these economies are actually being set up for strong periods of growth. And then there are opportunities in the emerging markets, et cetera, which I think in combination, it's not very difficult to add 20 basis points of additional return. Okay, let's just see what comes up next here. There was a request for an investment return sensitivity study, and that is alluded to on page 4 of the additional work product, and that's under tab 3. And what the GRS has shown us that for each deviation of 10 basis points in assumed investment return, that there is an impact of about 35 basis points in terms of additional payroll, or $6 million. And, of course, they also comment there that if we were to perform at 8% or better, even a 10%, 10 basis point increase over the 8% would have us at a break-even point relative to our annual required contribution. One of the significant requests, I think this was made by Representative Patterson, at the bottom of that same page, it said, board recommended new tier of benefits with varying return assumptions. You all will recall that the board recommended that we create a new tier of benefits for employees effective September 1, 2013, that would change the retirement age from 60 to 65, increase the average salary to 5 years, and most importantly, lower the benefit formula back to that it was at in 2001 at 2% of pay for each year of service. And we had done that before, but there was a request to see if we assumed 7.75% or 7.5% AIR on that, how it would impact. And I think quite clearly it would be very devastating if, in fact, we were to experience those level of returns. But we don't expect that that's what we're getting, at least based on the assumptions and projections that our investment consultant, they're suggesting 7.8, again, without active management. We think we can get that 8%. At the same time, there's no guarantee that we can, and our board is looking at this every year. They're going to be looking at it in February at our next meeting. We'll have updated numbers, and, of course, I can't predict what their recommendation will be in terms of ARR going before it, but it's on a significant watch list, and we think, however, that a couple of bad years of return aren't necessarily forecasters of the long-term future.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen anymore in the economy than anybody else, so the 8% could well be true. I just wanted to ask on the actual study there that you have on Appendix A, and I think that I probably didn't ask for it very clear, but I wanted to take a look at something that what I really want to show with two pieces and what I believe didn't show. So what we could just request two more squares, and the other squares would be, we'll title it study number 3, and I guess it wouldn't be an updated study 1. It would be a projection of where we are right now with the updated numbers, because what we had there in the original book, they had we originally have within the basic valuation piece with the current benefit multiplier, average salary, normal retirement, and assumed rate of return is 8%. And when we get the updated study here on 8, well, study 8 and the updated study 8 are what would happen if that Senate bill makes it all the way through, which is not a committee bill or anything that we wanted to measure with. We'd want to get good education for the committee. So I think it would be best for all of us to take a look at how these new updated numbers would affect the current valuation, separate of what would happen if that bill passed. And then really study number 3 should be the 7.5 return with all of those basic unmovable points of the current valuation. So if you got a 7.5% return and that bill didn't pass, that's what study number 3 would reflect. So those are, I think, the two things to better educate the committee on a couple of these different points is, where are we right now with the updated numbers, and then where would we be at a 7.5% rate of return, even though we might get 7.8 or 8.2 or whatever it may be, without the passage of that Senate bill. And I think that would be good for us to have as we work our way through educating ourselves on this process.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Mr. Pedersen, I think, and I could be unclear or uncertain here, but if you look at the updated Study 8 and Study 1 and 2, updated Study 8 assumes a 0% asset return for 2011. And it's bringing us up to through 2011, assuming we earned absolutely zero, and then projecting those funding ratios forward. Now, and then study 1 and 2 assume either the 7.75 and the 7.5, all built on zero earnings in 2011. We don't have our actual results as yet for 2011, but we think it's going to be pretty close to flat, quite frankly.
Mr. Chairman? I'm comfortable with those assumed rates of returns as illustrated. What I want to reflect, though, is the current benefit multiplier of 2.125% for 15, and then plus the 2.25% for over that, and then all of those original final and normal retirement issues. Those are the pieces that I think should be in an updated 8.
Yes.
And then study number 3 is what we'll call it, that has a 7.5 with essentially no change in those first three pieces across the evidence, Steve, that'd be great.
Okay,
so Madam Chair, just so I'm looking at what you're looking at, you're under tab 4, you're looking at the updated study 8 and study 1, study 2.
Correct.
And
correct.
What you're at, as I see now, you're looking at, those all reflect the joint bill that the Senate passed, and yeah. We did not.
Correct.
Correct. And you, and which would be the 2.15, the current multipliers is a big deal, and plus the 3 and the 60. Is that correct? 3 years and a 60.
Mr. Chairman, that is okay, correct, and good. The reason is because that would give us an accurate look of where we are with where we are currently, with an updated Section 8, and what would happen at 7.5 if that Senate file joint. Only Senate
and that, I think that's a good question. Then we get to see what 7.5 looks like now or with this Senate bill out
yeah,
there.
With the Senate bill or without a 7.5, I think
right.
That's all.
Got you. Because we know what it looks like with 8. I got you. Got you.
How Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
How much effort is that?
Well, we, Mr. Chairman, it's doable. I mean, it's
effort is.
Well, we've got a number of requests into our actuaries right now. Actually, they're working on developing a response in terms of a fiscal impact note as it relates to the proposed defined contribution conversion. And we are hopeful to get some preliminary numbers back from them as early as the 26th, and that's driving them really, really hard. What they've suggested to
when you make a request like that for that fiscal impact, what's the cost of that going to be?
Well, this initial request is a preliminary run at this. It'll probably just be a few thousand dollars. But to really know the fiscal impact of the closing of the DB plan to new entrants effective any date really is between $80,000 and $100,000.
Is that something you've pulled the trigger on?
No, we have not, Mr. Chairman, pulled the trigger on that. We have not received any funding or instructions to do so.
Okay. Now, with respect to what we're asking here, what's the fiscal or time impact of what the, if responding to what Representative Pedersen just asked for?
Mr. Chairman, I would be purely guessing at this point, rather before talking to GRS. This is a significantly busy period for those folks. However, I think, you know, they've always made us a priority when we tell them it is, and I suspect in 3 weeks or so we could have these rerun based on the current formulas as well as the prospective changes. The cost of this, I think it's probably $10,000, $12,000.
Mr. Chairman, when I saw this earlier, I actually went back and double-checked what I asked. And what I'm asking for is what I originally asked for. And I think it's extremely important to make the assumption that nothing happens and what that looks like with different performance levels. One, a continuation of where we are, and two, is a look at 7.5. And that's what, when we brought in the COLA conversation within that legislation that we passed as a committee is verbiage that reflects our performance for a 5-year, which is about 3.5, and a 10-year, which is about 4.5. And so clearly we have already stated that missing that 8 is somewhat of an important piece for the committee. And I guess I think that's an exorbitantly high number. But I feel like it's important to the committee. If you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, you're right. I want to be a good fiduciary of money, and it's $12,000. Yet I don't know. But is it better to be educated? I can't imagine that to change three numbers on an Excel sheet, given what is put in there, is a $12,000 request. Considering the exact same thing I could run. You tell me you want to retire early, retire later, live longer, live shorter, contribute more, contribute less, factor in more inflation, less inflation, better return, less return. Takes me under 2 minutes. I, 12,000 is probably a point where we need to be looking at a new person to be running these for us.
Mr. Chairman, you know, this is a guesstimate based on sort of similar requests we've asked of them, and particularly when we ask for them to produce things in a relatively compressed time frame. It could be less, but clearly I think these kind of illustrations could be part of a more comprehensive study and would probably be folded into that larger cost. However, it's this committee's decision. We'll incur the expense if, in fact, you want to see it.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how accurate we need to be, but I recall when we talked about these changes going to 5 years, the 65, the 2%, each one of those had a we had developed a matrix, and each one of them had a additive or effect of affecting the funding ratio. And I think we could get, you know, fairly close within a percent, you know, of what the funding ratio would be if we went back to that matrix and just compared the two. And, you know, we could probably get pretty close, and I think that would be close enough, you know, to make a decision as to whether or not, you know, we had a decision to make. And I think that's what we need to know is what, if we do get that information, what is that going to lead us to as far as a decision? Let's say, for example, that, you know, we got 5% difference in the funding ratio. Okay, if the 7% is actually 70% .8 or 75% .8, what does that tell us we need to do? And I guess I'd ask Brian if it's a 5% deviation, which I'm assuming it might be somewhere in there, what does that tell us we need to do?
Mr. Chairman, I'm comfortable doing a comparison like that, and you're right. What I look at this, and what is a 5%? What is a 5% deviation on a funding ratio? Well, if you just look at the new stuff in front of us, if everything goes well and we pass the bill, we got 0 and 11, and then we get 8 going forward. A 5% deviation in that in 2015 is when we are actuarially unfunded, because you go from 75 to 70, and 70 is that point of actuarial unfunding. And if you go all the way to the end, you get 7.5. In 2015, you're at 65% unfunded, which, to my recollection, is where Utah, I think, is right now. And when you look at these across the board, I mean, I guess that this is illustrative enough, and I guess we could make our own extrapolations from it. And you're right, I'm not interested in taking 3 weeks' time, especially, I guess, to get $12,000 of information that I could probably extrapolate out myself. So I guess we'll move without the request.
Just for a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman, because it was my understanding that that's what Representative Pedersen had asked as well for. So I'm just wondering if the department can answer if they didn't understand the request, or because I'm looking at this and, you know, that bill was – didn't pass this body, and yet I see all the funding in here for it. I don't remember hearing the request in the public hearings for that information, but I did remember hearing the request from Representative Pedersen.
Mr. Chairman, if I remember right, that what my recollection was, we were working off of a handout that assumed that the different benefits were going to be in place. And Brian, I have to be honest, I didn't remember you asking for us to do this with benefits as they currently are in place. My recollection was just to continuation of that report that we worked off of, that study 8, out of the original analysis we provided for you, and it just said run it at 7.5 and 7.75. So.
That's true.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it was done maliciously or inerrant or anything along those lines. I understand that. And I'm comfortable taking the information that we have in front of us.
Could we at least, though, know how much it costs to do this information? I mean, because the $12,000 has kind of got my head spinning, too. So how much, would you let us know how much they're going to bill us for this information?
Mr. Chairman and Dean, we will. Yes.
Well, look, here's the deal, is that Representative Pedersen has asked for some information. I don't think he's asking for you to reinvent the wheel. Rather, he's just saying put different inputs in and see it.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't cost that much. But the drill is that you know that there are folks out there that support moving to a defined contribution plan and closing this plan. And when those folks ask for information, even if it's harmful, the assumption is if you don't provide it, it's because you didn't want to provide it because you didn't like the results. And I don't think you ought to leave that. So I think you ought to figure out a way to provide the response without generating that kind of money. But what I don't want to do is have a barrage of requests and then find out a month later that you guys are telling your members, by the way, we incurred $200,000 worth of expense to respond to JAC over a period of 30 days. So you have to be judicious. And having said that, if this is simple modeling and you just put the caveat, so we took the model, this is what we did. If we had, there's a more expensive way to do it, but we didn't do that. But he's just looking for some runs, and it may be that what he's looking for is something that he thinks will show that under certain circumstances the fund will go bust. And and you could say that's not going to happen. But anyway, I don't want to send you out spending a whole bunch of money. I'm happy to say, look, forget it. But the flip side of it is that you can already see that by not providing it, they're going to make the argument that the reason you won't provide it is because it would show what they want to show, and that's that it would go bust.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly do appreciate your comments. You know, we've expended quite a bit of additional monies with this firm, and I suspect that it gives us some level of leverage. We'll go and, we'll incur the expense because the last thing we want left is the impression that we were intentionally not providing or responding to a request that a member of this committee made. I mean, I think it would be disingenuous on our behalf to think we could pull that off and it would go unobserved by any member of this body. So I can just assure you that it was not intentional, that this reflected what we thought the request was. And I will go and make an immediate call to our actuary and won't guess what it will cost and tell them that it's important for us to have it and have it as soon as possible. And, we'd like not to incur additional costs if that can be the response. But, we shared with this committee in the context of the consulting fees that we are being exposed to on behalf of GRS and other firms because of a lot of other proposed changes. And our consulting fees are almost doubling in some respects for actuarial services in large measure because of these GASB accounting rules that are going to be imposed. And as I understand it now, they're going to result in expenses for all the member agencies as well, in addition to those that are incurred by the pension system. But we will get this.
I'll tell you, just on that note, and that's a cost that we can't drive. That's just part of running a defined contribution plan or defined benefit plan. And I hear that, and there's a strong group out of there and that say that's all the reason why we should get out of this business. And you everybody put in their defined contribution, and they can ride it with the market. And, folks, the lobby literature is coming out full throttle now. There is absolutely no provision that the lobbyist group for the public employees or retirees would accept, except for the status quo. And I don't think the legislature is going to accept the status quo. So it's going to go one way or the other. And being indifferent and riding the fence as to say that we want no change, I don't think it's going to happen over the long term. So folks can figure it out, right?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to be completely clear that, and I said it on the record, and I say it again, I don't think there's anything nefarious or any malicious piece that was done. I fundamentally understand that there was probably, I mean, we asked for a lot of things that day. We have a three ringer in front of us of all the things we got asked. So if this thing was done that way, that's what it was, and that certainly wouldn't be. And I would also say, I completely agree with Tom and Steve about every single mathematical equation within this book. I just came to a little different policy decision on what the result is. I completely agree with everything they presented to us.
I don't care that you ask for the stuff. I think you're required to. And
but
I don't
Mr.
care
Chairman,
that you ask for more. There is a round robin effect, though.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to be clear that I did not think that they were, because the thought process that was presented is that people could do that, and that people would say that there was a purposeful withholding of information. And I wanted to be clear that now, for the third time on the record, that I am not one of those people.
Okay, and you don't have to apologize. We like what we have. I'm just trying to marshal where we're going from now, because the things that we ask for now are not going to be available in time for markup.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman.
So now what's happening is we're asking for information to gear up for the session. And we know what's happening. You know, none of us are uninformed, but there are two bills out there. And I'm okay with getting prepared for the session at this time. But I also know that this information, upon your request, and you know as well as I do, that it won't be available for markup. And we're looking at the next step. So, first of all, you don't have to apologize for anything. You asked for it. Nor do you have to apologize for asking for now for information that will help you in the session. But you are, as you point out, and we all are, have a fiduciary obligation to our constituents to make sure that we're asking things that make a difference. I think what your point was, is I thought I asked for something that was fairly easy to generate. The reaction I got from Tom was not the case. And I'm guessing, because I've been in this business, it's somewhere in between. And I think we're going to get it. So we're off that topic. Senator Meyer, then I'm going to go to you.
On the table itself there, we've got the asterisk that says it's the 30-year GASB arc represents the state share contributions actuary calculated to fund the plan. So the question I have on that is one, is that the contributions to fund the plan at that funding ratio, or is that the contributions that would fund the plan at 100% or any other percentage other than the funding ratio that's indicated in the study one or study two or updated study eight or previous study eight? And does that mean that the employees ratios are the same percentage, or do the employees ratios stay the same as what they are currently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, the illustrations assume the current employer and employee contributions, and that they would remain the same as they are throughout that forecast period.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, let me clarify, because the funding ratios change. Like January 2012, it's 10.99 on the far right, and 2040, it's 15.3%. And this is Appendix A, page
yes.
3.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Kurt, what that assumes is that there is no change in the contribution rate over that time frame. It assumes, this analysis assumes, it stays at 14.12% in total over the entire time frame. And the required the ARC, that is what we probably ought to be increasing to. But
okay, that's what I wanted to find out. Yeah,
but it doesn't assume that we have changed that at all.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing about this, and this is the way the actuaries always do that, is that 8.42%. That's on the employer share. So right now the employer is paying 7.12. When it says 8.42,
Yeah.
That's an increase of 1.56 that would be necessary to take us up to that 8.42. So it's kind of confusing, but that's the way they do it.
Okay. So it's not that we're doing it, but this is what we should be doing. If we wanted to be actuarially sound, we'd have to raise it, or we could lower it to that in the first previous study eight.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't pretend to know as much about this as my learned colleague to my left does, but I might be getting ahead of myself in the next tab when you're talking about the hypothetical retiree situation. Are we able to maybe go back 10 years and say, if we had done this 10 years ago, to compare how actuarially sound the fund would have been today, had we done this 10 years ago and went to a defined contribution at that point, just based on what the markets have done over that period of time?
Mr. Chairman, no, we've not attempted to go back to see what would have happened had we changed the plan structure 5 or 10 years ago. I think there'd be a number of assumptions that would impact that result. We can look at the markets, and I don't know what aspects of the markets and what weightings we give to various aspects of the markets. You know, there are lots of classes in terms of fixed securities and equities, and we know what we've done, but I don't know that it would be a particularly useful comparison. But if you're talking about tab number 5, what we were trying to do there, I believe there was a question as to what does the typical member of the retirement plan put into the system compared to what he or she gets out of the system. So we use the actual averages as they relate to our membership, which says, you know, the average age is 47, average years of service 10.5, the salary, the employee contribution balance using the current contributions, and then we projected that forward to their retirement at either age 60 or 65. And sort of two-thirds of the way down that page, it shows you excuse me, what the value of those benefits would be at retirement. And at age 60, it would be $445,000 roughly, and $641,000 at age 65. But significantly, what is shown in the column below is that the value of the contributions at age 60 is $251,400, having increased by 5.5% per year. That's the interest credit rate that we apply to those funds. And the payout, actually, as a result of investment earnings, that difference is $193,000. So they would get out $193,000 more than they had actually put in via contributions and the growth of on those contributions. There's also a small forfeiture factor that's built in there for when non-vested employees refund their monies, they forego any remaining contributions, any remaining employer contributions if they do that prior to vesting. And we were merely trying to illustrate, I believe, this point that some says people get an awful lot more out of the system than they put in. And in fact, it's intended to be that way as a result primarily of investment earnings.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. You know, and I don't have the first book in front of me, but you had all the studies, and as I recall, none of them had increased member contributions, as I recall. Is that correct? I mean, was there any? And I guess I'll just a little editorial on this, but we're running into a short budget session. And I think, I guess it is member contributions, I would think, money coming in would be one of the key drivers to help improve the system or the funded ratio or what everybody's concerned about. I guess my colleagues, whether learn it or not, I keep hearing about the funded ratio. And how would employee contributions? I mean, I think the chairman lined out in our last meeting was employees used to pay considerably more. We didn't get wages. We were frozen for many years, and it was like, well, we'll pick up the retirement benefits. It's kind of cheaper for the employer. And now here we are with good wages and low, really relatively low out-of-pocket member contributions. So how big a driver is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, contributions are significant. As you will recall, we had a contribution increase that became effective September 1 of 2010, and I think it's the first contribution in quite a number of years. And that increased the employee share by just about 1.43%. As we were discussing this with GRS, they indicated that about a 1.56% increase in contribution, whether by employer or employee, in fact, would put the plan on solid footing.
Now, what is solid footing? Is that a funded ratio?
Move us back to where the annual required contribution would be less than the actual contribution going into the plan, if that were to start now.
So, Mr. Chairman, so I guess my thing in all this we looked at, and we're running into a budget session, this is a huge, huge decision to think that we're going to come in here on a lot of emotion and work on a deal that's been a part of the state for decades. And I really want more information. I think if you ask employees, you ask anybody out there, should folks contribute more to their retirement? I think the answer from probably employees, the person on the street that we represent, but yeah, they should probably at least put in 5%, or, you know, I'm paying my 1.43 or whatever it is. And I just think, I don't know why that wasn't included. What would a 4%? I mean, if we jumped it from the 1.43 to that, I know you gave me another 1.56, that takes us to about 3%. And then you add that again and do a 4.5% total employee contribution. I mean, I think if folks understand that, hey, we need to increase contributions and we need to decrease the benefit multiplier, those are probably the two biggest drivers in my mind of this whole thing, assuming, I mean, the United States is still going to be here for decades after decades. Are those the two, and if it isn't, none of it really matters. So are those the two biggest drivers, the benefit multiplier and the contributions going in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, they are amongst the two. Obviously, investment earnings is
sure.
a significant other component of that. And I would suggest that as we have had numerous conversations with association members and individual members of the system, there has almost been full unanimity that to preserve the system, they would rather increase their contribution than to see it change. They would, I think, absorb a benefit formula change as well as increased contribution to preserve the nature of the defined benefit.
I guess then why wasn't any of those options brought to us? I guess that's what I would like to know, and that's my thing on this. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, I have no particular reason why those weren't. We had just experienced a contribution increase in the fall of 2010, and we recognize there's an environment in which there haven't been pay increases and the like, and to the extent that that is something you want us to develop, we're more than willing to do it, and it is a reasonable alternative to shifting to a defined contribution approach.
So is that information as well? I mean, we just had a request from my representative here down the table from me, and is that something you can get as well? I mean, I don't want to send you on all this either, but if we are truly going to ram this through in a budget session, we're probably going to need some information and a menu of options.
Mr. Chairman, this is information we can get, but I think it would be really a mistake if we don't determine in full the range of illustrations that we want to see so that we can go to them and give them a full set of assumptions. It's a lot cheaper and easier for them to run them all at one time comprehensively than to finish a set, then come back and ask us to change additional elements of it.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Madam Co-Chair, I guess we'll see how this is going to play out, but maybe if how this turns, whether any bill gets passed, one bill or the other, we'll have some. And come back with some more menu of options, really. We never had one of the big drivers as an option, and as we continue working this issue. So, thank you.
Mr. Trent, I wanted to follow up as well, because, five of us are new on this committee now. Going back to the December meeting, and we got that report that we had asked for from the March 2011 meeting. And we got the tables and graphs. And at one point in the meeting, I think it was you, Mr. Summers, you were asked to hypothetically comment about the possibility of the retirement system going to a defined contribution plan. And I think you had said that the expense to the state was going to far outweigh the benefits. Could you re-elaborate about your comments at that meeting?
Mr. Chairman, I think probably what I said was that at any time when you close a defined benefit plan, which is what the proposal does, and it doesn't terminate it, it closes it, so there's no new participants. If there is an unfunded liability in that plan, which we do have, about $1 billion, that the current participants in the plan, both employers and employees, would then be looking at an increased contribution rate in order to cover that unfunded liability. Typically, they make you amortize it over a shorter level, and as there's no new payroll coming into the system, there's less payroll if that contribution is being paid on, so there's a tendency to have upward pressure on that contribution rate. So without knowing exactly what that cost is going to be to close the plan, that's an important piece that's missing and really should be done before the decision is made to switch to some other plan. So there's going to be a cost to close that plan, and we don't know what that is. And that's what Tom was talking about in response to Mr. Chairman's question about the $80,000 to $100,000. That's what our actuaries told us that they would need in, 3 to 6 months.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. They said it would take, in a pinch, they could get it done perhaps in 3, but more typically it takes about 6 months. And we don't. And until they do that run for us specifically, we won't know the dollar impact. However, they have done, and other actuarial funds have done this assessment for Nevada and some other organizations, some other public pension funds, and they suggest to us the increase is generally between 10 and 20% in terms of the contribution level increase.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman, to coattail on Representative Harshman's comments that to make these heavy decisions in a short period of time with as many new members as you have on this committee, I'm really uncomfortable with it. You're talking about people's pensions. It's a big decision. I would feel more comfortable going into an interim study on it and learning more about it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I would agree that information is powerful, and we have to have it to make the decisions. And since there are bills pending, some of which have gaps in the information, I think it is very important that we have it. I would be equally hesitant to want to even increase the employee contribution to a plan if I don't know how solvent it is, and to put that burden on their backs, say with a guarantee, and I don't think either one of you would give me a guarantee that that's going to solve the problem, and ask them for the next 10 years to carry that burden, and then we just flip it anyway. So information is power. The person who holds the information holds the power, and I think this body and the 60 and 30 need to have it, and I don't think the cost of it matters because we're talking about a lot of money.
Pardon me. Mr. Chairman, the next item is an update on Plan A paid firefighter pension. We were asked to calculate the cost of funding the unfunded liability that exists in that plan. And what the GRS has calculated, if we were to contribute a lump sum right now, it would take between 57.6 and 67.9 million. And the reason there is a range here is that they put in 50 basis points or a half a percent for so-called adverse experience. And that would allow that more monies might be needed if investment results, in fact, weren't what were forecast to be, or there were negative movements in any of the other assumptions relative to inflation, salary increases, and the like. So it's 57.6 to 67.9. We were also asked to determine what if this money were set aside into the state auditor's office in an account and would be partialed out over time. And then the cost increase there is between $79.5 and $92 million, using the same assumptions apart from the fact that there would be no investment earnings on the money sit in the account. Also, at our December meeting, there was some discussion around how any surplus after all the retirees and beneficiaries in Plan A had all of the benefits had been paid out and there were no liabilities remaining. And there has been an attorney general opinion that's illustrated under Attachment 7 that suggests any surplus remaining in Plan A would go to Pension Plan B for paid firefighters. So to the extent that there was concern that the monies would now be unretrievable as a result of it being in a trust, appears the AG's opinion would address that concern. Vol EMT pension plan. There were a number of questions asked as to the environment and the intent for additional contributions at the time that plan was designed, and we were asked to do research in our files and our actuary's files to determine if there was any evidence pointed in one direction or the other. And we were able, as you can see under Attachment 9, to provide or to uncover some of the original studies surrounding the establishment of that program. And it shows in those studies that $978,200 that was originally funded for that program was estimated to fund the cost of the benefits for the 2009 and 2010 biennium, and there was clear indication in the materials that there would be additional ongoing funding responsibilities. And it's our sense that the current appropriation is going to be depleted in approximately 4 years, so we've got a little bit of time to figure out what that ongoing funding source will be, if any. going to page 6, there was a history of contribution increase, a history of lump sum appropriations to the retirement system. And as you'll take a look under Attachment 11, we provided that based on let me just make sure I'm under the right. That's the Attorney General's. Let me see I'm under attachment. Oh, actually, it's right behind. Next page, I'm sorry. Next page, 7. And it shows that year by year from 1949 through the present, those contributions or appropriations that have been made by the legislature. Now, these, I must clarify, were not made to address shortfalls in the system. They were approved or appropriated by the legislature to fund benefits that you, in fact, approved. And the only one that was given to us to address a so-called shortfall is the $150.6 million in 2009. And that, too, was intended to address an unfunded liability created by increased salaries and therefore benefits applicable to teachers. It's actually right, it's on page 7 of the initial book, of the initial presentation. It's not in the tab, actually. It's page 7 of the first 11 pages. And a couple of things that I believe were not asked for in the meeting, but we elected to toss into the book. Background on COLA decision methodology. This is a document that you had been provided in the past, as well as a purchasing power retention study we included.
The item that was not or was asked related to microfiche and microfilm conversion. I guess we, in our budget request, had asked for $400,000 to convert the addition, the current microfiche and microfilm to digital. There was discussion surrounding whether the state archivist had a policy and was moving in a digital or fiche direction. So we had conversations with them. They have not made a decision one way or the other. As we understand it, they do maintain their materials in microfilm media, if you will. They accept that digital is the more modern way to go. They are only concerned about digital, while it's a permanent storage medium, is that it is subject to data corruption, that someone could go in and alter the data in some way, or that some virus or something could corrupt the data. That is certainly a legitimate concern, but not one that we are terribly concerned about, because we back up this data on a daily basis, actually on pretty much an hourly basis. So if one set of digital data were corrupted in some fashion, it would not prevent our retrieval of it. Also, digital storage is a more efficient method of storage. It requires less space, and it's more efficient to get the data out of it. So there are expense savings using a digital method. And we've not used microfiche, I believe, since 1999. All of our records have been stored in data. And the reason we wanted to convert these, as you may recall, is that the old media is disintegrating. Well, Mr. Chairman, that's it as it relates to the follow-up questions that we were asked. I believe we were asked, in fact, to prepare, working with ANI, a new expense org for the investment team, as well as to discuss the creation of an incentive program. And that material has been distributed. I believe we work closely with Mr. Boswell and his team. And this reflects the numbers that were given to you in the budget when we met in December. The only
Mr. Chairman, you know, you had asked us to break out the investment team into a separate expense org. And so I think the budget office, Fulbert, has prepared that. I don't know whether it's been handed out yet or not, but what it would do, Mr. Chairman, is take the salaries that were approved by the governor and the positions that were approved by the governor, which were three. He denied our fourth position. It would take those salary amounts. I think the budget office reworked the benefits that we had originally asked for, and reworked those that they're a different figure than what's actually in your budget. And that, have you all got this? Okay.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman, the first set of columns is what we had originally requested. With the last position there, the senior investment officer, that's been with an asterisk, that's what the governor denied. That would have been an additional investment position. The three that are presented there are current positions. Those are the salaries we requested for. Remember, those are biennial figures. And then the budget office put those into a different expense org, reworked the benefits, because the benefits we'd asked for, they determined were probably too high. So the difference there between those two columns is really just the proposed benefits. Again, all this was that's presented here was approved by the governor, and so I guess it, you know, when you work the budget, if you wanted a separate expense org, you just need to instruct staff in the budget office to break these three positions out and put them into a separate e-org. And Mr. Chairman, if we're going to do that, the board would like to make a couple of comments on that. If you're going to do that, that's fine with us. We have no objection to breaking that investment team out. I think it's a good idea. we would like you to consider putting our executive director position in the same eorg. And the reason is because he spends about 35% of his time on the investment program. And if you get a chance to go through the Hewitt-Ennis-Knupp report, this report that we had just received a couple weeks ago, looking at our investment program, their recommendations were to maintain that relationship between the ED and the investment team. I thought it was a good approach and one that needed to be kept intact. And if we're going to be allowed to pay these kinds of salaries to our investment people, that we also be allowed to pay a comparable salary level to our executive director. And if you give that consideration and want some more information about what that would cost them, we can certainly provide that to you. The other issue here is, and this goes back to our attempts in the past, the board's attempts in the past to get an increase in salary for our CIO. I think you're all familiar with that. We had problems getting that by the governor. Eventually got it done. It was too late. The governor did approve these salaries, and these are higher than what we're paying, and they're higher than what we were asking him to approve in 2010 and then earlier this year with Governor Meade. They are higher than that. But we would like for you to consider allowing the board to make the final decisions on the salary as long as we stay within these budgeted amounts. In other words, right now, because these salaries are off the chart, we'll be right up front about that. When we make a request to A&I, it goes straight to the governor's desk. And what we would like to be able to do is sit down with these folks, and when we decide that or negotiate with them and want to make somebody an offer, that we can make them an offer and not have to go have the governor approve it. We're asking for autonomy in this respect for this eorg, for these three positions. We're asking you to consider adding the ED to that, and we'd ask you to restore the other senior investment officer the governor removed. So those are the issues that we have and the things we'd like you to consider when you work the budget.
Mr. Chairman, and I shared this with them earlier, it's clear that if you're going to run your state's second largest pool of money, you clearly need the right people to do that. And you had mentioned somewhere in this book, and I'm sorry if you already said where, but I didn't hear that there was a study that shows that we are probably undermanned in this area in comparison to several other of comparable places, and I didn't see it.
Mr. Chairman, that I believe was put inside the binder, right? And it's a report that we just had Hewitt-Ennis-Knupp prepare for us, and they looked at our entire investment program, compared us to peers, and did a number of things. It's actually, Brian, it's a whole separate report. Should have been stuck inside the binder. No, that's the cover memo for it, and I believe that's the report itself. So what that report indicated to us, and so one of the recommendations was, first of all, that, yeah, we need to be competitive in our salaries, that we need to look at our staffing levels, and we need to maintain the relationship that we have with our ED and our investment program. There's some other recommendations in there, about 8 or 10 or 12 of them. I know you guys are tired. I don't know. We need to go over them all right now. The other recommendation was that we consider some autonomy with respect to budget and some autonomy with respect to the RFP process. We're not asking you to consider all of that, just autonomy with respect to this particular expense org. Mr. Chairman, what you'd have to do is basically exempt us from Title IX statutes that require all this stuff to run through A&I.
Of course, we could do a total autonomy, and it would be called a defined contribution plan. All right. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Is that it? Is that everything you present, Steve?
Pretty much, Mr. Chairman. The only other thing, and again, this is the board, We really would like you to consider all the reductions the governor made. I know what you're going through. I know what the situation is with the revenue and the rest of state government, and I know you have a big job. You have a bigger job than we do. But we would feel remiss if we did not at least request that you consider that, because we think we need those resources to run this program the way it needs to be run.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you all.